Are you searching for the best in online black radio? Then go to blacktalkradionetwork.com, helping you filter through the noise. Real talk, black talk.
The internet is full of half-truths and all-out lies. We've all seen them, and many people on social media complaining about it. Here's your chance to show and prove. WorldAfropedia.com is a black-owned and operated encyclopedia. There are several thousand articles, but we need help. We can't uncover all the truth ourselves. So please, join us and become a writer, editor, or blogger for WorldAfropedia.com today. Every little bit counts. We owe it to the future generations to put the truth out there. Visit WorldAfropedia.com, the African-centered encyclopedia, a global database of African knowledge for the purpose of bringing about global African wisdom and understanding. WorldAfropedia.com.
North Carolina.
Wilmington is the site of the only coup d'etat in U.S. history. In 1898, a mob of armed white supremacists torched the offices of the local black newspaper, killed many African-American residents, and overthrew the elected government. The coup went unpunished by the federal government. The only black daily newspaper in town was at the center of the massacre. The Wilmington Daily Record published an editorial a few months before that overthrow in response to a speech that advocated for the lynching of black men who protect white men to protect white women. The article argued that it is possible to have a consensual relationship between a black man and a white woman. John Jeremiah Sullivan zeroed in on the history of the newspaper as part of a larger research project on the 1898 coup. He's a writer for the New York Times Magazine, based in Wilmington, and joins me now from partner station WHQR. John, welcome. Good to have you here.
Thanks for having me.
Tell me what drew you to this history of the Daily Record.
Well, it was part of a larger research project we were working on having to do with 1898 in general and with the coup and the massacre that followed, in which an unknown number of African American people were murdered here in Wilmington.
And so, what was it? Well, tell me about what did the Daily Record project look like once you got it started?
Well, we were fascinated because we kept seeing these mentions of the newspaper in writing about 1898 and in published writing about the massacre and coup, and there would always be a sentence along the lines of "Sadly, no copies survive." In reference to the Daily Record. And the longer we kept at it, the more that just started to seem impossible that there would be no surviving copies. And, of course, the newspaper is so important to everything that happened in that year. Not only was it at the center of the coup and the massacre, in fact, the first person killed that day was killed right in front of the newspaper building. It was also central to the way events developed over the course of that year, because Alexander Manley was the editor, his editorial on interracial sexual and romantic relationships had done so much to foment the atmosphere in Wilmington. But there was a third thing that fascinated us, which was more positive in a way, which was just that the Daily Record had been one of the best, really kind of a shining symbol of what the African American community in Wilmington had become prior to the massacre.
Yeah, maybe I'm going to ask you to stop there and give us the picture of Wilmington, North Carolina in 1898, when this white supremacist mob, led by some of the leading citizens of the state of North Carolina, white citizens, I might add, launched this coup d'etat. Tell me about Wilmington.
Well, you had this thing happening called fusion politics in North Carolina at the time. It's really interesting and still not as widely known as it should be. And Wilmington was the capital, not the true capital of the state at that time, but was the center of fusion politics. And this was an explicitly interracial political movement that was born from a fusion, hence the name, of white populists, many of whom were from the outlying counties, and black Republicans. Republicans in general, many of whom at that time were African American. Of course, we have to keep in mind that the liberal conservative polarity is switched, right? So the Republicans are the Progressive Party at this time, and the Democrats are the conservative one. So the Fusion Party was an interracial party that was trying to undo the old Democratic order, which was what was left of the slaveocracy, and they were making strides and winning elections, especially in 1896. They had a lot of success, and the Democrats got they picked up on the fact that this was the end of the old order, and decided that they had to put an end to it, and if they couldn't stop it by legal means, they would resort to violence.
That assault on democracy was vital to white supremacy then, and perhaps even today, with voter suppression and some of the other things that we see happening. But we're going to stick with Wilmington, because one of the reasons that this is all happening in Wilmington is because its economy is not based on the old slaveocracy. There is a brand new economy. It is the most prosperous city in North Carolina at the time. It is a majority black. There is a large middle class that thrives not on agriculture, but on trade and business. It's a new North Carolina, and it needed a new politics, and about the only way to stop it was an assault on democracy and a coup d'etat. So it's a fascinating moment in North Carolina history, and of course, fomented by a pillar of democracy, a free press. So you are now looking for some of these papers, the actual Daily Record that printed these columns and, as you say, got people somewhat agitated. You ended up finding 7 copies of the Daily Record. Where'd you find them?
3 of them were on microfilm at the Schomburg Center for the Study of Black Culture in New York City. I think those were the first we found. And there is one copy at the State Archives in Raleigh. And that's the actual issue containing Manley's editorial, the editorial that made so much trouble. It was described as scandalous. Of course, we read it now, and it's almost hard to understand how it mm-hmm. could have been. But the white supremacists were able to use it to whip up violence in the months leading up to the election in 1898. They reprinted it over and over in other newspapers. Kept it in front of people's faces. And then a really wonderful thing that happened, early on in the project, we got a call from the Cape Fear Museum, the local history museum here in town, from the staff historian there, a woman named Jan Davidson, who had heard about the project and said, "We have 3 copies of the Daily Record in our archives." And that was special because, you know, we were working with these groups of 8th graders, middle school students, and
tell me more about that, about bringing the 8th grade students into this project.
It started that way early on. I'm not sure how we settled on that age group. It may have been the coincidence that my older daughter Maria was in middle school herself at the time. But we started meeting with them once a week, with groups of students from 3 schools here in town, 2 public and 1 private, and just kind of presented them with this historical problem, in some ways a conveniently tidy historical problem. You have this major event in American history, the coup and massacre of 1898. You have this publication that is at the center of it in every way, and the publication is gone. It's been erased. And in fact, we know that there were deliberate measures taken to erase the Daily Record. So some of the Democratic, which is to say white supremacist newspapers here in Wilmington, published advertisements saying we'll pay 10 cents or 25 cents per copy of the Daily Record. So they're buying them up and presumably destroying them. Mm. Which is one reason why they were so hard to find. But so we were able to say to the students, you know, here's this important piece, and it has been missing, and now we have some copies, so let's read them. Let's find out what they say, what was going on, how much can be reconstructed of that thriving community that had existed before and just up to the massacre.
And of course, all we knew up until then, or most of what we knew, was because of reprints or quotes in other papers, including white supremacist publications that somehow maintained a piece of the record when many of the actual artifacts were gone.
That's right. It's an irony of this research that a lot of times you're reliant on the white supremacist sources because they're attacking the Daily Record and its politics, and quoting long stretches of it in their own articles as a way of saying, "Can you believe what these people are writing?" But unwittingly, they're preserving a lot of copies. So we've actually put together an eighth copy, what we're calling the remnants issue of the Daily Record, and that's made up entirely of material that survived by having been reproduced in other newspapers and magazines at the time.
I want to bring another guest into this conversation who can put this project into the larger context of the black press. Cash Michaels is a journalist who writes for publications around North Carolina. Welcome back, Cash.
Good to be with you.
Tell us about the importance of the Daily Record at the turn of the 19th or turn of the 20th century.
If I'm not mistaken, the Daily Record was perhaps one of just two, if I have that right. And John, it's good to be on with you. And you correct me where I'm wrong because you know your project better than I do. But I believe there were just two daily African-American newspapers in the country at the time. So to have a black newspaper, particularly as you correctly indicated, Wilmington was the de facto capital of North Carolina because of it was a port city, and so it was thriving economically. The African American community there was just not only proficient as far as business is concerned, but government, property owners, the arts, a lot of artisans, the legal profession, etc. So it was a capital, no question, and it was a majority black city, and it was a target. The white supremacist leaders of the state felt that it was a symbol of something they did not want. And I think someone said something about they sought legal means to they wanted to wipe them out, period.
Well, it gives lie to the theory of white supremacy. This was the objection to the to supporting Haiti and its independence earlier in the century. Again, Southern Democrats opposed that because if the lie of white supremacy is we're better and all of a sudden we've got the best city in the city showing us up, you need to put a stop to that.
Yeah, exactly. And so Wilmington was a place to be proud of. And there were lawmakers from Wilmington who were very well respected, very well known. And you just had anything good that was happening in the black community in North Carolina most likely had links to Wilmington, if not from Wilmington itself.
You know, John, I want to talk to you about some of the details of what you're finding as well as we kind of put this whole piece, historical piece together. You include, there's a Charles Chestnut story that was included in some of the, Charles Chestnut, of course, a great writer, African-American who is from North Carolina and who did a lot of his writing here. Talk about that and just that find.
Yeah, it's amazing. There's almost a kind of a Pompeii aspect sometimes to looking at this material from the decade leading up to the coup, because when the African American community here was destabilized as violently as it was in 1898, there was so much cultural memory lost at the same time, and that has been in some ways the most interesting part of the project is resurrecting that earlier world a little bit and realizing just how sophisticated and advanced it had become. I mean, there was really it's not an exaggeration to say that there was an African-American literary scene here in Wilmington with weekly meetings. They would have these Friday night literary gatherings and poems and stories were being produced. And that was one of the interesting things to find out about the Daily Record itself was that Manley was running fiction. He was running short stories and poems, and that was a new fact for us that the Daily Record had possessed this literary dimension. And it just throws into relief how much was destroyed.
Cash Michaels, what does the black press landscape look like today in Wilmington? We'll start there.
Well, let me just interject this before I answer that question, and I think John can pick up on this. Through his research, which is an extraordinary project, they were able to find an editorial. And John, if I'm not mistaken, I believe you're not sure whether Manley wrote this, but it seems likely, where he wrote an editorial, I think, in October of 1898. In effect, saying that even though he had already begun hearing rumors that weapons were being brought into Wilmington for the express purpose of causing violence and damage and destruction in the black community, that he just could not believe. He just simply could not believe that the white power structure there would stoop to that level. This was in October of 1898. And mind you, he was very explicit in what he was writing, too. We're hearing that guns are coming in, this, so forth, you know. And yet he said, I'm hearing all this, and I just don't believe that the leadership here would do such a thing. I think more of them than that. And, John, I think you can pick up from that point, because I think that's something you showed me, I believe in February or January of this year, if I'm not mistaken. And it was something that was extraordinary per your discovery.
It's really a tragic document of American history. And that you're right. It was October of 1898 when that editorial was published. And yes, Manley is talking to his people. He's talking to his community, to the African American community here in Wilmington and people who are reading it in other parts of the state, and saying, listen, they would never be that crazy. Don't let them scare you. They're just talking this way because they want to keep us home on election day. But don't forget that these people are our neighbors, and that we do business with them, and we live next door to one another. And they would never dare to resort to the kind of violence that's being hinted at. And it's hard to read it, almost, knowing how wrong he was on the facts, but how right in spirit. I mean, he was speaking as a truly democratically minded person. Mm. You know.
Yo, check it out. It's just a friendly game of baseball.
1963 was a turning point for the U.S., and as much as it was complicated for the country, it was all the more intense for one particular 13-year-old girl. Her name is Sharon Robinson. She is the only daughter of the legendary baseball player Jackie Robinson. Here's a bit of what 1963 sounded like to her.
And I say segregation now, segregation tomorrow, and segregation forever.
Satisfied until justice rolls down like waters and righteousness like a mighty stream.
Wow! Everybody sing! Yeah, yeah, yeah! Yeah, yeah, yeah!
1963 was a swirl of teenagedom, divisive politics, and sometimes complicated family dynamics. Sharon Robinson writes about all that in her new memoir, Child of the Dream. She joins us now in our studio. Welcome.
Oh, thank you, Elsa. That was an incredible introduction. it brought me right back to 1963, music and the words.
Well, I want people to be able to picture your life in 1963. Mm. I mean, you were one of only two black girls in your entire school, right?
By 1963, yeah.
Right. And reading the book, it was clear that the kind of racism you had to contend with was much more subtle than the racism that your dad had to contend with as a baseball player.
Yes.
Why was it hard for you to tell your father about what kids were saying to you? I mean, because you didn't tell him about it till way later.
Because it seemed so minor in comparison to what the kids in the South were going through.
Yeah.
And we saw that on the television. So therefore, like, why bring up, you know, name calling? We didn't talk about bullying back then, mm-hmm. or think of it as even bullying. So I didn't realize what impact it was even having on me at the time. And so I'm really looking back as I got older and realized, oh, yeah, that's why I was so shy in school.
Yeah. There's this really, really sweet moment when you were listening to records with your best friend, Candy.
Candy,
who's
yes.
also African-American. And you're trying to connect with your idea of what it means to be Black through music. You're listening to these Motown records. And when I was reading that part, it made me feel like, wow, this girl feels disconnected from what it means to be Black. Jackie Robinson's daughter feels disconnected.
I did. I was very happy as a young child, you know, in my white world. You know, I had my horse. I had my best friend, Christy, who lived down the street. But I realized when we were turning 12 that something was very wrong here, and I had to pull away from this white world in order to be a part of the Black world. And I really wanted that.
Well, because of your dad's fame, you had a front row seat to the civil rights movement in a way the vast majority of 13-year-olds in the Northeast in 1963 did not. Your family hosted jazz concerts at your house to raise money. Martin Luther King Jr. came for a visit. In a way, it felt like the civil rights movement was delivered to your doorstep, but you were still shielded from the most terrifying aspects of it. Did that make it harder for you to figure out how you fit into the struggle?
These kids were my age, and I found it frightening. I found it exciting. I wanted to be a part of that and not, you know, sort of isolated in Connecticut where we were doing our own thing. But, you know, no one talked about it or paid much attention to what we were doing.
Yeah.
And I sort of envied these kids that they had each other and they were part of something bigger than themselves because we knew that that's what we should be working towards.
Were you frustrated with your father when he wouldn't let you go down to Birmingham in March?
You know, I wasn't frustrated so much as like, well, when do we get connected? You know, when I'm watching these children, I felt, you know, sick in my stomach, you know, that I was frightened for them. Yeah. And also very proud of them. But I didn't know how it was going to turn out. You know, all I saw was them going to jail.
Mm-hmm.
And then we go back the next night and watch it on television again. And I'm like, what's going on? What's going to happen to these kids, you know? And so I continued to be worried about them until my father came back from Birmingham finally and could give me a more full report. Well, did you meet any of the kids? You know, what's happening? What's, you know, are they going to be punished? Are they out of jail? Are they safe? And that's when he gave us an action.
Right.
He came back and said, we're going to start doing fundraisers at our home. And you kids are going to be as much a part of that fundraising as, you know, your mom and I are going to be. And everyone will have a role. And the money we raise will go back to Birmingham or wherever the money is needed in the civil rights movement. And that first jazz concert, I got it. We worked hard and it was an incredible experience, but we also produced money.
Yeah. There you are getting the hot dogs ready, the hot dog buns, the sodas, the plates. And just give me an idea of what it was like to be in it.
When we're getting up in the morning to clean our rooms and get it ready for the artists, we're also wondering, well, maybe Dr. King will see my room, you know? So,
you know, it's very extra good.
Extra good, you know. It's very, and then we didn't also know what it was going to be like, you know, whether he was going to be a distant figure, and even though he's in the house, you know, whether we would be introduced to him, but then, you know, he wouldn't have anything to say to us. And then Dr. King acknowledges us. And looks to us and says, you know, calls us foot soldiers. And I don't think I really knew what foot soldiers were at that point.
But
you know,
it sounded really important.
But it sounded like, you know, we are marching. You know, we are part of this march.
So you have written several kids' books now. Why write this particular book at this point in time? Why choose only this moment in 1963?
I thought it would be helpful for kids to understand that children had a voice in the civil rights movement.
Yeah.
And that helped change the tide, helped us get the passage of the Civil Rights Act.
Right.
And turning 13 is, to me, was, you know, such a big deal.
Right.
You know, it was really a big deal. So I wanted to.
I mean, it was the year you had your first kiss, but also the year the civil rights movement had launched, at least in your consciousness.
Exactly. So it was just wonderful to be able to pair these things. I felt, this is important for kids to know that I didn't, now I come to your classrooms and you see me as a confident and accomplished woman, but that didn't just happen. I had my own trajectory and I wanted to share that with kids.
Sharon Robinson's new book is called Child of the Dream, a memoir of 1963. Thank you so much for coming in today.
Thank you.
Top black athletes choose historically black colleges and universities over predominantly white ones. Jemele Hill makes that argument in an essay in The Atlantic. She says it would benefit not just the colleges, but also the communities around them and just maybe those student athletes, too. Jemele Hill, welcome to All Things Considered.
Thank you for having me.
So the case you're making is black athletes bring all kinds of money, all kinds of attention to the often predominantly white universities that recruit and showcase them. And meanwhile, historically, black colleges are struggling. Is that right?
That's kind of a basic blueprint that I make. Looking at the shape of HBCUs, who generally speaking do not have large endowments, why not take your talent to these HBCUs and kind of rebuild these historic institutions?
I get why this could be great for historically black colleges and universities if black athletes took their talent and the money that follows them there. Why would this be good for the black athletes?
Right now, it wouldn't be, because a lot of the HBCUs, they don't have the facilities, the infrastructure. And it is unfair because we're talking about 17, 18, 19-year-olds. So you would need a group, frankly, a whole exodus of athletes who would think a little forwardly in order for this to happen, because
making a collective decision, let's all do this and take our collective bargaining power.
It can't be one or two, because one or two is not enough to help to rebuild these schools, the communities around them. And I think what would be a trickle down effect into strengthening the black middle class with a very solvent, steady, stable financial base, I think is just a huge benefit all around.
When it comes to black athletes, though, you quote one in your piece who sums up the counter argument to yours pretty eloquently. This is Kayvon Thibodeau, the top high school football prospect. He visited Florida A&M, and it was a huge stir that he had visited a black college, but he ended up at University of Oregon. And the quote, I'll read it unless you want to. He said, "Nobody wants to eat McDonald's when you can get filet mignon."
As I said, I don't think there's any question that there is a difference between a University of Oregon and a FAMU. Facilities, just everything.
The exposure, I'm thinking, in terms of somebody who might be good enough to go pro.
The exposure would be the least of the issues, because there are players in the NFL and the NBA who went to black colleges right now and they were found. And I think that's part of the mentality that some of these young athletes have. They think the schools make them. Teams want to get better and they want to go where the talent is. And it's the same with television networks. They follow where the audience goes and where the talent is. And so from an exposure standpoint, I don't think there's any question that the exposure would certainly follow them.
Is there any precedent for what you're advocating? Has there ever been a group of rising college athletes who've banded together and made a collective decision in this way?
Not to go to a black college, but probably one of the more famous examples is the Fab Five. Jalen Rose and Chris Webber, both are from Detroit. They got to know the other members of the Fab Five, Juwan Howard, Ray Jackson, Jimmy King, and five freshmen went to University of Michigan and changed college basketball. And I don't see why that couldn't happen for an HBCU. So while, I know I was speaking from a standpoint of utter utopia, because it's a little bit more challenging than that. But I do think it's possible.
Your piece has kicked up a big fuss on Twitter and beyond. I've seen some critics saying this amounts to an argument for voluntary segregation. What do you say to that?
I think those people don't know very much about HBCUs because HBCUs have never been segregated, okay, ever. White people could always go there. There are white people that go there right now a lot. There are white quarterbacks and white football players and basketball players playing for HBCUs. What I'm saying is moving the base of power to an HBCU. And what's interesting, especially because so many conservatives have had something to say and have called me a segregationist, even a racist, is that now, correct me if I'm wrong, but conservatives, especially when it comes to talking about the black community, they're always telling black people to pull themselves up by the bootstraps, right? Always saying that. So I actually suggest an idea that basically is rooted in that, and suddenly I'm a racist. I find that to be highly ironic.
That's Jamel Hill, staff writer at The Atlantic. Thanks so much for talking to us.
Thank you guys for having me.
In the Bahamas, thousands of people were left homeless by Hurricane Dorian. The storm was a great leveler, both physically and socioeconomically. It struck down the seaside mansions of the rich as well as the shanties of the poor. But recovering from disaster is especially difficult for people who are struggling to get by to begin with. One of the neighborhoods that was hardest hit in Marsh Harbor on Abaco Island was home to thousands of immigrants, many of them from Haiti. NPR's Jason Beaubien reports that migrants have been some of the most desperate in the days after Dorian passed.
During the worst of Hurricane Dorian, 42-year-old John Noel says ocean water poured into the shanty town where he lived and quickly flooded his house.
After 10, 15 minutes, the water just come up, bap, 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 way higher than the window. The water come through the window, come everywhere. And after that, we got to walk. The door, we was inside the house, we can't open the door. We got to climb up off the window to get off the room.
The sustained winds of 185 miles per hour were firing pieces of sheet metal and tree limbs through the air. Noel says he and his girlfriend clung to the top of a 10-foot-tall iron gate to keep from getting washed away. He says he believed he was about to die.
Only God could save our life.
The neighborhood, known as the Mud, where he used to live, is now a field of debris with not a single building still standing. Thousands of people, most of the migrants, lived here, and the death toll in this neighborhood is thought to have been immense. Since the storm, Noel has been sleeping in a Catholic church. He says there's no way that he can stay in Marsh Harbor, and what he really wants right now is to go back to Haiti.
You can't do nothing. They have to clean that and do plenty of stuff. So the thing is we need to get a move from there and go now, so buy our own ticket and go home. That's it.
At the dock in Marsh Harbor, hundreds of people, many of them Haitians, are waiting for what's known as the mail boat to Nassau. It's a fairly large ferry that, in addition to the mail, also carries shipping containers and passengers who normally can't afford to fly between Nassau and Marsh Harbor. During a tour of the hurricane devastation, Bahamian Prime Minister Hubert Minnis stopped by the dock and addressed the crowd of people desperately trying to leave the island. He assured Haitians that they will get just as much disaster assistance as locals.
All of you will be treated with respect, so do not be afraid of my government. All of you will be treated equally. There's no discrimination here. We are all one.
Yet, even the Prime Minister's words underscored how marginalized Haitians and other migrants have been here. Julio Ortiz from the Dominican Republic had been working in Marsh Harbor for 6 months when Hurricane Dorian hit. For nearly a week after the storm crashed into the Bahamas, he hadn't been able to get in touch with his wife back home. We lend him a phone. He says the cell phones haven't been working, there's no internet. He doesn't speak English and hadn't been able to get a message to his family. He says it's a relief for him and his wife now that she knows he survived the storm. Ortiz came to the Bahamas to work and to make money. On this day, he's scavenging through a pile of hurricane debris, trying to find a propane gas bottle to hook up a stove. He hasn't worked since the storm, and with most businesses damaged and shut down from Dorian, it may be weeks, months, or even longer before Ortiz can find more work. Jason Beaubien, NPR News, Marsh Harbor, Bahamas.
Hurricane Dorian not only left many people without homes in the Bahamas, it also left the students at the University of the Bahamas without a northern campus. But one college here in the U.S. has opened its doors to those students. Hampton University is a historically black school in Virginia, and it's decided to pay tuition and room and board for these Bahamian students for one semester. To tell us about those plans, we're joined now by the president of Hampton University, William Harvey. Welcome.
Thank you very much. Good to be with you.
So tell me how you arrived at this decision to spend this kind of money to help these students. I mean, we're talking about, what, around $20,000 per student here?
Well, the president of the University of Bahamas, Dr. Rodney Smith, is my former vice president. And one evening, I called him just to ask how he and his wife and family were doing. He told me they were doing fine, but that his North Campus had almost been obliterated. So I thought about that overnight, and the next morning I called him and told him that Hampton would pay room, board, and tuition for the students from the North Campus.
And how did he react?
Oh, he was delighted. But since that time, we have gotten $100,000 from one of our trustees,
wow,
and we're going to use that money to try to help pay for I-20s.
Visas, you mean.
And other kinds of costs for these students.
So how many students do you expect to be taking you up on this offer?
Well, I will tell you, within 8 or 10 hours, we had 22 students. By the end of the day, we had 50.
Wow.
Yesterday, we had 151.
A lot of these students who will be arriving on your campus have lost their homes. They may be leaving family behind. I mean, they're entering a whole new community. What are your plans for providing, say, counseling or other mental health services on your campus?
We have had 3 meetings yesterday. We talked about all of that. We've got dormitory space for them. We've got a counseling center with certified counselors, because some of them may have PTSD. They may have some other kinds of mental issues.
Mm-hmm.
We've talked to the people in our Department of Psychology because we're moving to do a number of those things.
Now, this is not the first time that Hampton University has offered support to students after a natural disaster. You guys opened your doors after Hurricane Katrina as well. And I'm just curious, as an HBCU, do you feel a special responsibility when it comes to disasters that disproportionately affect black communities, like the Ninth Ward or like the Bahamas?
Well, let me just say to you that one of the things that Hampton has done from its very beginning is to provide help to others. We were founded by General Samuel Chapman Armstrong, and he was a Union general, a white man that wanted to provide an education for recently freed slaves. So a part of our DNA is to help people, and we did help some of the Katrina victims.
Yeah.
I think we had about 40 or 50. This looks like we're going to have more than that. We've gotten a lot of fanfare on this one, but we do a lot of things that people don't know about because we aren't doing it for any reason other than it is the right thing to do and it's the best thing to do, and we're going to continue to do that.
Well, I wish you all the best. William Harvey is the president of Hampton University. Thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you very much.
Hey, man, shoo-be-doo. Shoo-be-doo. Then the hand shakes. And somebody would say, what does that mean? Oh, shoo-be-doo, man. Get with it. You know, to oop to school. Now, these are people who are supposed to be intelligent. It's not a plan for finding uranium on the moon. We're not scientific at all. We're not scientific at all.
Our next story of being in the wrong place at the wrong time is about a young scientist. This person was brilliant and ambitious and would go on to bring hope to a whole bunch of people who had been condemned to a life of suffering and isolation. But today our hero is barely remembered, maybe because she was a she and African-American, and the year was 1916. Paul Wehrmacher first got wind of the story when he was working at a research library. He's retired now from the University of Hawaii.
It was a serendipitous thing. I was working at the Science and Technology Reference Desk, and somebody came and asked a simple question, do you know if there is a Chamugra tree growing on campus?
That tree, the Chamugra tree, was central to a discovery that now seems obscure, but at the time was a huge deal. And the person who made it was Alice Augusta Ball. Ball grew up in Seattle's Central District. Her grandfather was an early photographer, one of the few black experts at a technique called daguerreotype. Paul Wermager imagines that awakened Alice's interest in chemistry.
I think as a child, can you imagine seeing a piece of paper being submerged into a liquid and then all of a sudden out of it comes a picture? I think it was very unique and it made her very unique.
She would go on to study pharmacy at the University of Washington and showed huge promise.
She actually got two articles co-published before she even got her master's degree in the most prestigious chemistry journal in the world. So that struck me as, wow, this person is pretty amazing.
Alice Ball headed to what was then called the College of Hawaii for graduate school, destined to encounter that Chamugra tree. The thing that brought tree and chemist together was leprosy.
It was considered a death sentence. Not only that, but then you were taken away from your family. And in Hawaiian and Polynesian and Asian, family is the most important thing. Once you lose that, you're kind of, well, you're dead in some ways.
It, of course, is biblical in its conception.
That's James Harnish of Harborview Medical Center in Seattle.
The stigma with the almost terrifying skin and facial disformities. So all of that tends to make somebody with leprosy an outcast.
Harnish runs Harborview's Hansen's Disease Clinic. Hansen's disease is another name for leprosy, which Harnish has been treating for a half a century. He says that for most of history, people with this disease were simply isolated and left to die.
There was no treatment at that point in time at all, so it was a matter of just offering care while you're watching the disease progress to destroy the face, destroy the hands, the arms. It was a very sad situation.
There was one folk remedy for leprosy, though it wasn't super effective. Oil extracted from the seeds of a tropical Asian tree called Chamugra. But using Chamugra oil had drawbacks.
People were applying it both to the lesions as a salve as well as injecting it in an oil-based preparation. The injections were extraordinarily painful, but it was observed that people who used Chamugra oil actually showed some benefit.
So the challenge was this, to come up with an extract of the oil's active ingredients that could be mixed in water and injected without pain. A local surgeon in Hawaii took up the problem, and he contacted Alice Ball for help. It's hard to understate how daunting that assignment was. Alice Ball was just 24 years old and fresh out of undergrad, for one thing. And, of course, this was 1916. There were no modern centrifuges or gas chromatography. But there was a brand new, still obscure method being developed in Europe, and Alice Ball found out about it.
People were struggling just with, what do you do with this oil that if you let it set, it just hardens into like lard. But using alcohol, you make it into what's called an ethyl ester. Then it becomes water soluble. And that was the breakthrough that she made.
It was the first practical injectable extract of Chamugra oil. And for the first time in human history, there was a dependable, effective treatment for this feared and ancient disease.
The people who did finally get the injections did show remarkable improvements. I found photographs, and they're just startling. The person looks like really a different person.
Now, Chamugra oil was not a cure. That would come later with new drugs in the 1940s. But James Harnish says it gave a group of doomed people hope for the first time.
You have to understand, she was doing this before women had a right to vote. This is amazing. And again, she was an African-American woman. Phenomenal that she could get this far.
So where is Alice Ball in the firmament of pioneering scientists? Where's the statue and the biopic and the endowed chair of chemistry or whatever? Well, that would have been a great question to ask Arthur Dean. He was president of the College of Hawaii, and he took up Alice Ball's work. The thing is, people assumed it was Dean, the white man, who had the breakthrough. And he accepted the credit that should have gone to the black female prodigy.
So then his name became attached to this breakthrough with Shimogura, and people forgot about Alice.
And it gets worse. This should have been just the opening to a brilliant scientific career for Alice Ball. Instead, just months later, at age 24, she had an accident in the classroom.
Well, according to the newspaper, recounts two of them say that she was demonstrating some experiment in class and got poisoned by chlorine gas.
Alice Ball died before she could watch her research transform so many lives and without getting proper credit. It wasn't until the last couple of decades that her name has resurfaced, thanks partly to Paul Wurmacher of the University of Hawaii. He nudged the university to honor Ball, and he personally established a scholarship in her name. These days he's retired, but still working busily to write Alice Ball's biography.
I never ever had a sister when I grew up, and I always kind of wanted a sister. So I have kind of adopted her as my sister. And I only want the very best for her because she was so ignored, which is, you know, that's a wrong.
For its part, the University of Washington has not memorialized this extraordinary alumna, besides one UW employee planning her own gift in Alice's name to fund women of color junior faculty. But in the summer of 2019, Alice Ball did get a measure of recognition in Seattle.
At the age of 23, she discovered what is now known as the Ball Method after isolating the ethyl esters.
This is third grader Jessie Balnick. According to her mom, Jamie Clausen, Jessie learned about Alice Ball in a book called Goodnight Stories for Rebel Girls 2. She created this video and launched a campaign to convince the Seattle Parks Department to name a small park after Alice Ball.
There is a new park opening up next to the Greenwood Library. It's a park where kids and their families can come to read and learn from the books they check out. We think it would be wonderful if that park could be named after Alice Ball so kids could remember that learning can change lives and that learning can look like all of us.
The push succeeded. Alice Augusta Ball is now the namesake of a park in the city she was born in. It's taken 100 years, but this pioneering black woman chemist is finally taking her place in the history of science and in bedtime stories for rebel girls everywhere.
Since you're my special friend, come closer for a special treat. I'm going to let you touch me in a special place.
It is never okay to touch someone else's private parts. Your mom and dad will tell you so.
So the MIT Media Lab is the latest institution tainted by Jeffrey Epstein's money. On Saturday, the director of the lab, Joey Ito, resigned, writing in an internal email, quote, "After giving the matter a great deal of thought over the past several days and weeks, I think that it is best that I resign." But in reality, Ito's soul-searching was likely expedited by reading the reporting of Ronan Farrow, who has uncovered that the MIT Media Lab not only knew about Jeffrey Epstein's status as a sex offender, but that they went to great lengths to conceal Epstein's financial contributions and his connection to those of some of his high-profile friends. Ronan Farrow is a contributing writer to The New Yorker and author of the forthcoming book Catch and Kill, Lies, Spies, and a Conspiracy to Protect Predators. His reporting for The New Yorker won the 2018 Pulitzer Prize for Public Service. Ronan, thanks for joining us.
Always a pleasure. And thanks for having me.
Yeah, congratulations on another great piece of reporting. Because until your piece posted on Friday, we thought that Joey Ito's involvement was far less than you discovered. What did he initially say, and what did you discover?
Yeah, what we found, as you summarized accurately, is that there was both a far larger scale of relationship with Jeffrey Epstein, consisting of donations directly from Epstein that were anonymized, and also donations from other contacts of Epstein's, other billionaires, who were also anonymized. And then secondarily, we found that as you alluded to, there was a much deeper and more concerted cover-up, in the words of some of the whistleblowers that I spoke to.
And when you say some of his billionaire friends, some that I guess a person or two may have heard of, like Bill Gates, for example, who is denying any Epstein connection to the giving. Is that correct?
Well, we include his statement, which appears to be very carefully phrased in the article, and I'll let that speak for itself. But certainly he's saying that he, you know, didn't have a significant relationship with Epstein, where Epstein was directing his contributions. He doesn't answer the question of whether he and Epstein had contact about these specific contributions, as the emails or documents that we have not only suggest, but appear to confirm. I mean, this was a situation where both Ito and Epstein really credited Epstein with that Bill Gates donation and described it as being directed by Epstein.
You know, Ronald Farrell, you have some incredible details in here about the nickname that Epstein had around Ito's office. Tell us about that.
Yeah, I mean, we all have to be thankful here for these whistleblowers who decided to speak. And uniformly, they did so because they felt a moral obligation to do right by both the survivors of Epstein's predation, and also I think the larger issue of whether important institutions that we care about and respect, like MIT, should be engaging in this kind of a relationship and an effort to conceal it. And, you know, they described wrenching stories of feeling conflicted. One of the anecdotes was indeed that there were so many anonymized secret references to Epstein and his contacts at the lab that they started referring to Epstein as Voldemort, or he who must not be named.
From Harry Potter.
So we're talking
from Harry Potter.
We're talking to Ronan Farrow. So the guy was disqualified, had disqualified status as a donor. So obviously there are two choices, not to take money from him or money that he facilitated, giving that he facilitated, or to do this hiding. And from anonymizing it, to use your word, in Ito's schedule, which I guess was a public schedule, it would either say things like VIP or whatever else could be done to make it unlikely that anyone outside his small universe knew that Epstein was he was talking to Epstein, or Epstein was making an appearance or a contribution. Is that a fair statement?
I think that that's a fair statement. Now, that doesn't mean that the wider MIT community was completely oblivious. You know, we in this reporting focus on this circle around Ito, and, you know, there are hard documents there, and we quote many of the emails internally saying, you know, this is from Jeffrey, it needs to be kept anonymous. Here's this Bill Gates donation directed by Epstein, make sure that it's only described in any official filings as an anonymous donation directed by a friend of the donor. And on like this. That said, while we describe an effort to conceal the full extent from the Central Fundraising Office, it certainly does appear that the Central Fundraising Office had some awareness. And, you know, we leave the door open to MIT's examination of how far that went. As you mentioned at the beginning of this story, we have evidence that Jeffrey Epstein was listed as being disqualified from contact with MIT in their donor database. And by the end, they were accepting all of this money. And it appears that, you know, part of that process was basically that they decided to undisqualify him, which would not be a unilateral Media Lab decision. You know, that would involve the Central Fundraising Office as well.
You know, I want to go up the chain, if we can, Ronan Farrow from The New Yorker, for a second. When this story pre-you originally broke, the president of MIT, Reif, as I think he pronounced his name, says, with hindsight, we recognize with shame and distress, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Then he goes on to say, after your piece is posted on Friday, because the accusations in this story are extremely serious, they demand an immediate, thorough, and independent investigation, et cetera, et cetera. To me, I can be less objective, I guess, than you. There's a Captain Renault aspect to this thing. Either is it likely that someone up the chain outside the Media Lab would have known about this, number one? And number two, did President Reif need you to do your work to know that an independent, immediate, and thorough investigation needed to be done of Jeffrey Epstein's ties to the university?
Well, I'll leave that last question about what MIT leadership should have done to others. You know, we're here just laying out the facts. I will say that there are a lot of whistleblowers we talk to, a lot of people within the MIT community who are asking those same questions. As I said, you know, this reporting suggests that, yes, there was this concerted effort to conceal these contacts within the Media Lab, but also, yes, that this was not something that MIT, in a wider sense, was totally unaware of. And certainly, you know, the moral discomfort of these sources, who are, you know, good people who signed up to do good work, right? They wanted to be engaged in noble research that would contribute to the greater good, and were put in this tremendously uncomfortable position. They were signaling this for a while and quite noisily, you know, on mass emails, in group discussions. This community was already roiled by this, and many of them are alarmed that it took this degree of exposure and, you know, sort of public finger wagging, which has come in response to my article, in order to prompt action.
We're talking to Rona Farrow, who's just written a devastating piece about the MIT Media Lab and perhaps many others' knowledge of financial contributions to the lab from Jeffrey Epstein and some of his associates. Tell us the story of the Signe Swenson person, Ronan.
Yes. So Signe Swenson is a great example of why we all need whistleblowers in a corporate setting, in an academic setting, in a government setting to ensure accountability. She was a development associate, first in the central fundraising office, and then within the MIT Media Lab. And she is one of a group of sources who went out on a limb to try to expose what she described as a cover-up. When she was hired from the central fundraising office to the Media Lab, she felt that it was an explicit part of her mandate to cover up this relationship. It was in her earliest conversations about the job. She was told that they had this contact with Epstein, and very quickly, when she started the job, those conversations became still more uncomfortable for her as they appeared to, she said, seek ways to cover up the donations and keep them flowing. And she really was particularly uncomfortable when Epstein was invited to visit. And there were all these conversations where leadership at the lab made clear that they were aware Epstein would be coming with two young women, and that they were aware that he was a convicted sex offender, you know, with a track record of established predation on young women. And so she and a number of other female members of the staff, especially, you know, were morally conflicted as this played out. They were told to keep a professor who was critical of the contact with Epstein away from line of sight with the office in which Epstein would be taking meetings, which had a glass-windowed wall. You know, they felt this was a cover-up, and they saw these young women who they said were Eastern European-looking, seems to be maybe models, and who sort of waited outside during these meetings with faculty, and they really were concerned for their safety. Swenson describes, you know, trying to be extra nice to these young women on the off chance that they're there against their will. And, you know, I think for people who care about an institution like MIT and the work that it does, that's a terrible position to put staff in. They really felt that there was a chance that this cover-up, again, to use their word, was allowing Epstein to use MIT and his relationship with it to burnish his reputation, to keep his reputation afloat in the wake of that conviction, and possibly to continue his predation. So that is, you know, the great debate. Is there anything wrong with taking this kind of money from someone with this kind of a criminal history? And their answer, the whistleblower's answer, is yes, because he then used it as a shield that maybe allowed him to harm others.
You know, I suppose I shouldn't be surprised at anything anymore, but I guess there's something so bizarre about Jeffrey Epstein showing up
with the models,
with these two young women who look like Eastern European models, to a meeting
it
at MIT.
Bizarre. And
everybody,
no doubt about it.
Yeah, everybody just kind of says,
Except for the Swenson woman.
Yes, the women that were concerned about them. Did that kind of knock your socks off, or am I being naive here?
I mean, I think it knocked their socks off, and not in a good way. That's why there were these whistleblowers who, you know, leaked documents and gave accounts of this. You know, I should say, in defense of this community, which I think is full of a lot of wonderful researchers and other members of the staff, It wasn't everyone saying, oh, this is great, this is okay. A number of people confronted Joey Ito about it. There's a faculty member named Ethan Zuckerman,
yes,
who
yep.
Posted a very moving post about why he was resigning his connection with the Media Lab over this. He confronted Ito about it, and that's an anecdote that we have in the piece. So thank goodness there were people who found it as bizarre as you're finding it, hearing about it, and did something about it. But it did take years, and they don't know who came to additional harm in those years. So yes, it's bizarre. It's not something you would ever see if you weren't taking a lot of largesse and a lot of money from someone.
Speaking of a lot of money, Ronan Farrow, is the amount of money that you're reporting that Epstein is credited with securing for MIT through others, at least, was a couple of million dollars from Bill Gates and $5.5 million from this Leon Black, this investor. They made a point, I guess it was Ito, that said they were going to donate the $800,000 that they had acknowledged when a month or so ago that Epstein had contributed to charity. Has there been anything from the leadership of MIT about what they're going to do with the $7.5 million?
They have said only that there will be an independent investigation, and of course Ito resigned. And Peter Cohen, who was working under Ito and is on many of the emails that we excerpt in the piece, has also been suspended from his job at Brown, where he currently works.
And one last thing from me, Ronan Farrow. You mentioned Harvard University's donations. Tell us about those.
So there were a number of institutions that had relationships with Epstein, and certainly we know that Harvard was one of them, like MIT. Epstein seemed to be very proud of his associations with these schools. He, you know, was photographed wearing Harvard sweaters and talked about it a lot publicly. And it seemed to want to embrace the kind of patina of prestige that these schools gave him, even though he hadn't attended them. You know, this fundraising relationship really gave him something that he could use to curry further favor with influential people. And Harvard, for its part, has said, you know, we are not giving back any of this money, you know, and that has not changed in the wake of these recent revelations.
Well, they obviously can't afford to return the money. They're from paycheck to paycheck.
That's right.
Couples trying to get pregnant may have turned to an ovulation or period tracking app for help. Millions of women around the world use them for a variety of reasons. But what happens to the very personal data people enter in these apps? In some cases, it gets fed to third parties, including Facebook. That's according to a new report by the UK-based advocacy group Privacy International. They looked at these apps being used in different parts of the world. There's Maya, Maya Femme, My Period Tracker, Ovulation Calculator, and others. Eva Bloom Dumonte led the research on the period tracking apps.
And what we found is that the ones that are both called Maya have very worrying practices because essentially they ask their users to enter extremely sensitive data, not just about their menstruation, but also about their sexual life and also all sorts of medical data. Like their birth control pill, but also even like their blood pressure, any sort of medical history they might have. And this is all shared with Facebook and other third parties.
And those other apps that you mentioned, are they also acquiring the same kind of data?
All of them actually are collecting very sensitive data. The other ones, we're not sharing it with Facebook or other third parties. But what they were doing, though, is that every time the user would open the app, they let Facebook know that the user is opening the app. So Facebook knows that you're using this app, which means that you're a person who menstruates, that probably if you open the app, that means you're at a time of your cycle where you're actually on your period. It probably also tells Facebook that you may be either trying to have a child or trying to avoid getting pregnant. So there's a lot of information already that can be inferred from just merely letting Facebook know that you've opened the app.
And just to be clear, I mean, this information, the app developers would say this is legitimately needed to make certain determinations about fertility, correct?
Yeah, so it's needed for them, but what's, you know, absolutely not, you know, mandatory is sharing it with Facebook.
So what does Facebook do with this data, with this information?
It's unclear at this stage what Facebook does with this information. What we question is why a company like Facebook should have access to this data. When we think back to the reality of what has happened with Facebook collecting so much data about us in the past, and obviously I'm thinking, for example, about the Cambridge Analytica scandal and the targeting of population in the context of election, it is worrying that a company like Facebook would hold so much data and so much personal intimate data.
Who around the world is typically using these apps?
So the apps we've looked at are particularly popular in India, in Indonesia, and in the Philippines, actually.
Right. And women there, are they're giving this information voluntarily? I mean, do you know if there are concerns about this, about privacy in those countries?
We partnered with BuzzFeed for this research, and they've interviewed users of these apps in various countries. And obviously, sadly, a lot of users are simply not aware of the data collection and the data sharing of those apps and their practices.
Right, which seems like that ought to be changed. If people are unaware, they should be made aware. I mean, how clear do these apps make it in their terms of
Absolutely
service?
Absolutely not. In fact, because we have been looking at the privacy policies of those apps. It's worth bearing in mind that, you know, for the general public, for the average person, it would be actually quite a difficult thing to read. It's not, you know, necessarily written in very accessible language. It's quite long. They do not explicitly clarify the extent to which they share information with third parties. So we actually question even the legality of those privacy policies that are not sufficiently transparent, not sufficiently explicit, especially when, as I said, they are collecting medical data.
I mean, the thing is, even when people are aware and they then decide to fork over the data, they're doing it willingly. They're doing it voluntarily, right?
Well, but there is a question to be asked about, or those people doing it voluntarily when they don't actually understand what's going to happen to this data and when it's not properly explained to them. You know, in European data protection legislation, there's a really important notion, which is informed consent. If you don't understand what you're signing, it cannot be understood as informed consent. And that's actually what we would argue in this case. It can't be argued that they were really consenting to this.
Eva Bloom Dumonte with Privacy International, speaking with us from London. Thanks very much.
Thank you so much. Bye-bye.
And I see so many males, young males in my practice who have become psychotic, almost never to return to normal from marijuana use because you don't know what's in it. You don't know how it's been genetically altered. Again, everything has to be put in the context of a power dynamic system of racism and white supremacy.
Federal health officials went to the White House today and got the go-ahead to banish flavored vaping products from the market. The Food and Drug Administration action is aimed at an epidemic of teenage vaping. NPR science correspondent Richard Harris reports.
When these products came on the market, some people welcomed vaping as a potentially safer alternative to cigarettes. And while millions of adults have switched from cigarettes, vaping has also drawn in a new generation of nicotine addicts. The latest survey of youth tobacco use shows this trend is continuing, says Secretary of Health and Human Services Alex Azar.
We are seeing a continued surging of middle school and high school children using e-cigarettes, increasing frequency of their use, and children being drawn in by flavored e-cigarette products, including mint, menthol, bubblegum, mango, alcohol-flavored, etc.
Speaking to reporters outside the White House, Azar said he was directing the FDA to develop a plan that will ban these child-friendly flavors. Tobacco-flavored products would still be allowed, at least for now, he said, intended for adults as an alternative to cigarettes.
But if we find that children start surging into tobacco-flavored e-cigarettes, or if we find marketing practices that target children and try to drive the market share into tobacco-flavored products, we'll engage in enforcement actions there also.
Health advocates said this step is long overdue. Paul Billings at the American Lung Association says his group and others successfully sued the FDA to force regulation of vaping products. He suspects the recent outbreak of serious lung disease among vapers has finally put these problems in the spotlight.
And unfortunately, it's taken this crisis to finally prompt this action.
Health officials don't know whether flavored products have contributed to more than 450 cases of lung disease, including 6 deaths. But people who are addicted to nicotine and vaping devices put themselves at risk, he says. The FDA says it intends to finalize its new policy in the coming weeks. Richard Harris, NPR News.
Context of white supremacy. Gusty Renegade in for another broadcast, hopefully to share constructive information on the system of white supremacy. Today's date, Saturday, September 14, 2019. So I have been told this is our weekly compensatory call-in. Dial in if you have thoughts, counter-racist suggestions, questions. The number to dial, 605-313-5161. 64, the code 564-943 pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. Number again, 605-313-5164, the code 564-943 pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. Whew. Many things to share this week. Let's see. Number one, I am super excited. Tomorrow, I'm looking forward. Black female that I know, been talking about eating better, trying to cook together, to cook more vegetables and be healthy. She is a black mom, so she has lots of motivation to take care of her health so that she can be around, to take care of her children, be a black grandmother at some point, hopefully. Lots of motivation. So we've been looking at different recipes and trying to cook things and even trying to change some recipes that generally would be with meat products and that sort of thing to make them a little healthier, get more veggies and that sort of thing in. I'm always a big advocate of encouraging fruits. Get away from those sweets and get more fruits in your system. They have amazing peaches here. I have lived in Georgia. I have lived in California. They have pretty amazing peaches there too. But wow, amazing peaches here. And they're huge. There's a one-year-old that I know, godchild. The peaches are about as big as her head. So if you can envision a one-year-old's head, peaches are about that big. Whew. Wow. And they're amazing. Super sweet. Just incredible. They were on sale this week. Organic, no less. They were on sale this week. So I got a bunch of them, pounds of them, and immediately said, oh, vegan peach cobbler. I've never made vegan peach cobbler before. I've never made cobbler before. Never even been, you know, a fan of cobbler, even though I know it exists. But I immediately, vegan peach cobbler. Have to do it. The peaches are so good, and they were so inexpensive with the sale. So I looked up. They have lots of recipes. Found one that I liked. Got all the ingredients. I am excited to make vegan peach cobbler tomorrow, especially or a component of my eagerness is if it turns out well, and I have every expectation that it will, if it turns out well, I was thinking we could make this for the yoga retreat in December down in Florida, but then I thought, I don't think peaches are in season in December, so we might not be able to do peach cobbler, but I am sure we could figure something else out. If it comes out well with peaches, we could just pick a different fruit that is in season and work with that. But whew, excited for the vegan peach cobbler. We'll let you know how it turns out. Maybe even have a picture. I'm extra excited for the COWS 2019 10-year anniversary counter-racist yoga retreat. Planning for Florida, December 28 to January 1. Lodging, meals included. Everyone will have a bed. There's a swimming pool at the location that we're looking at. should be a hoot. We will have counter-racist workshops, mandatory that at least one will include workplace racism, because that was such a item of discussion back in Virginia. But we will have counter-racist workshops to offer constructive suggestions on different subjects. We will have food workshops showing how to prepare meals, maybe even the vegan cobbler. But different entrees, how to prepare vegetables that are tasty, healthy, and will be enjoyed, maybe even devoured by meat lovers. We'll also be doing yoga every day, taught by Gus T. Really looking forward to getting some sunshine and getting away from all of the so-called holiday nonsense that generally happens during the end of December, and setting ourselves up, hopefully, for a constructive 2020. All of the information is on my blog, racism-notes.blogspot.com. racism-notes.blogspot.com. You can check it out. Drop an email if you have questions about the retreat, cost, what we'll be doing, where we will be staying, meal items, all of that. If you have input or suggestions, feel free. Looking forward to having a constructive end to the year and a great beginning to 2020. Untiljustice@gmail.com if you have questions, comments, or concerns about the retreat. Speaking of yoga, so I got this internship so that I could get more opportunities to teach, be a better instructor. Hopefully I'll be a substantially better instructor by the time we get to the retreat. I'll retreat because I will have taught a lot more classes and learned a lot more, be even better. So I've been going to the studio, learning, preparing. If you're in the Seattle area and you want to come take a class that Gus T is teaching in a really nice studio, drop me an email. I will be teaching the 29th and the 6th. Drop an email. Let me know. You can come take a class. We can discuss counter-racism. Maybe we can even go to the library at the studio. They're giving me a tour of the studio where my internship is. They have a library upstairs. Reading is more important than watching television. Of course, I go check out the library. Now, most of the material that they have, they're yoga books. Duh, yoga studio, that's what you would expect. Anatomy books, muscles of the body, yoga sequencing, yoga postures, that sort of thing. That's what you, or yeah, that's what one would expect if a yoga studio is going to have a library. Hark, I continue to look through the books. They have a copy of Rebecca Skloot, The Immortal Life of Henrietta Lacks. Cal's Book Club, right? 2014. I look and, whoa, what is this doing here? I look again. Maybe I misread. You know, could be an illiterate nigra. I look again. Immortal Life of Henrietta Lacks. And I think to myself repeatedly, what is this doing in a yoga studio library? They didn't have any other books. They didn't have Ta-Nehisi Coates or James Baldwin, The Hate U Give, New American Classic. They didn't have any of that, but they had The Immortal Life of Henrietta Lacks. I said, I will have to ask the white yoga instructor who owns the studio, how did this book get here? Why is this book here? Have you read this book? What did you think? Quite a few questions, because we did read that their book on the book club 2014 in the archives. Next, speaking of archives, I think the very first clip that we played was about Wilmington, North Carolina, 1898. White terrorist attack. They use that word coup there. This past week, this is the 18-year anniversary of 9/11. They use the word terrorism. They've been using the word terrorism for 18 years now. They didn't use the word terrorism, white terrorism, in Wilmington, North Carolina, 1898. Cal's Archives, Christopher Everett, he made the documentary film Wilmington on Fire. It is spectacular. He's a guest on the program towards the end of 2015. It's one of the best documentaries that I've seen in terms of accurate information about white supremacy, racism. I highly, highly endorse folks checking out the film. There are lots of screenings if you're in the North Carolina region, so just be mindful. You can follow him on Twitter and his social media accounts, Mr. Everett, and see when the next screening will be, but it is definitely worth the time and energy. You will learn a lot. It should be mandatory viewing if you are in North Carolina, but I thought that was so important. One, the deliberate effort to destroy Black journalists and the work of Black journalists. This is consistent. Mr. Everett talked about that in the documentary. They burned down the actual building, the premises where Mr. Manley had his Black press operating from in Wilmington, North Carolina, and that was done deliberately. That was one of the first areas attacked in the terrorist raid, white terrorist raid. But I thought that was so important because that is so consistent in the system of racism, white supremacy. I think even now I've heard many folks talk about difficulty in obtaining copies of Mr. Fuller's books or Dr. Welsing's work. Sometimes that's been difficult, or they'll be really expensive trying to get them from different websites online. The context of white supremacy, how the disruption to our archives, the iTunes feed not working, we've been kicked off the air repeatedly. All of this is a deliberate effort. Ida B. Wells Barnett having to flee for her life and just barely getting out of town. There are so many, barely getting out of Tennessee, be specific. There are so many examples of Black journalists, Black people, period, but Black journalists especially, who've made an effort to just try to report about racism, white supremacy in an accurate manner. And the threat that that represents to racism, I think that that is critical. And it represents another illustration, in my view, that is evidence that the system of white supremacy can and will be defeated. If that was not the case, if this system was just going to be permanent on infinitum, whatever, have you little nigger, you know, press, whatever. We'll come and help you pass out your little journal. Who cares? You can write until the end of time, and we will just continue to dominate and terrorize Black people, and you'll just write about it forever and stack newspapers up to the heavens. That would be the attitude, not let's go burn this down immediately and kill them off so they don't get to publish any more of this. That sounds like, oh, wow, maybe they could get things right, get a correct understanding, and do something correct to solve this problem. Next. we had, wait a minute, before we move from the Wilmington situation, I also thought it was critical. White people are not ignorant about racism, white supremacy. Victims of racism, non-white people, are the ones who are confused about racism, and we do not understand what it means to be classified as white. Sometimes we are even reticent to believe what it means to be classified as white. What the grandsister, Dr. Welsing, she used to say that her job as a general and child psychiatrist was to help people deal with reality even when they are reluctant to do so. Mr. Manley, for all of his spectacular counter-racist work in that segment, they said that he got information, specific detailed information that, the whites are stockpiling guns. Haven't we heard that before? The whites are stockpiling guns, ammunition, all kinds of weapons, and they're coming to attack us. And he did not want to believe, Mr. Manley, he did not want to believe that the whites were going to do that. He said, oh, no, this can't be. This is the great state of Carolina. We have a democracy. Didn't Dr. Welsing talk about that? You don't have a democracy. We have a system of white supremacy, local, national, global. That's what we have, and violence is necessary. That problem that you heard from Mr. Manley, that was 1898, all this time later, unfortunately, you see the same problem where there is reluctance to understand and accept what it means to be classified as white. That's a product of white supremacy as well, but that is something that needs to be addressed. Just accepting truth, even when we are reluctant to do so. And in, right in the same topic, white people are not ignorant about white supremacy racism. The Jeffrey Epstein case, great illustration. You can learn a lot just studying that case, why I keep playing different segments on it. And, you know, lots of folks are talking about it, Cynical African included. We've talked about white sexual deviance as collective cultural pathology and seeing, you know, the Jerry Sandusky, seeing this behavior repeat itself over and over for centuries. Thomas Jefferson, fondling fathers, seeing this repetitive cycle of sexual terrorism. With Jeffrey Epstein, this is another illustration of white people cannot be ignorant about racism. How many times? It's not just one report. It's been multiple reports of many, many white people all over the world who knew about Mr. Epstein's incorrect sexual terrorism and didn't do anything about it and or aided and abetted in concealing this really criminal behavior. That is standard operating procedure. The same way that white people were aware, oh, it looks like he is raping these young girls. What did they say in the report? They said officials at MIT are accused of, well, if you have a problem with Mr. Epstein raping these young girls, we'll just make sure that we keep you away from him when he comes to visit. Hope he cuts us another big check. That's not ignorance. That is willful concealment. And if anybody acts like they have a problem with this, well, you'll just make sure you get whisked away. Maybe you even get fired or don't get tenure or whatever it's going to be. Make sure you don't mess up things around here. Again, that's standard operating procedure. And I mean, if you think it operates, it only operates with regards to covering up sexual misconduct. This is racism, white supremacy all the time. And the only difference being with racism, white supremacy, they use the metaphor whistleblowers in this case to say that you had some white people step up and say, hey, this is incorrect. And even, you know, one professor, they say, resigned, and other people were writing and talking about this. But with racism, white supremacy, you don't have that, generally speaking. They just collectively go along with, yep, not hiring the niggers. Yep. Raping the niggers. Yep. That was Jerry Sandusky. Wasn't that the allegation? That's in the Cal's archive, too, that Jerry Sandusky was specifically targeting non-white children. These foster care children, throwaway children, as Dr. Welsing would call them. That's what we heard before. They're not ignorant about white people going out and raping these young children in the Catholic Church or wherever else that it's happening. They're not ignorant about that. And they certainly are not ignorant about how the niggers are mistreated worldwide. Next. And they even had a nickname. They had a nickname. That's a metaphor, too. He who cannot be named. That is codifying how we are going to conceal. We're not even going to mention his name so that we can get some distance from all this. Pretend that this is not even connected to us. Standard operating procedure. They had the segment about Alice Ball's scientist. I was struggling. I failed to find the clip where Dr. Welsing was talking about that. That's what we should aspire to be scientists. And they mentioned Alice Ball and her work. And, you know, she's totally been erased, just like the black journalist in North Carolina, erased her work and contribution. So we don't think of black people as scientists. That's another standard operating procedure. But they mentioned that there is no recognition of her at the University of Washington. That's right, literally down the street from me at the University of Washington. If you walk on that campus, you would think that no prominent black people have ever been there. If you just walk around and look at the photos that they have of students who've done great things or professors who've done wonderful things, accomplished something, you would think that it is all white people. In fact, Bruce Lee, a non-white person that I know, Bruce Lee attended the University of Washington. They don't even have, they did not have anything that even signified that with the status that he has on an international level. They didn't even have like a little plaque or anything that said, oh yeah, Bruce Lee went here for a few years. But other than that, it's been all white folks. They didn't even have that. Non-white person that I know had a years long campaign for them finally to put up a garden that says, oh, yes, this will be the Bruce Lee Garden, and remind people that he did attend the University of Washington. But they don't have anything to signify her presence there. And then they said that while she was alive, she's doing all this great work. trying to address leprosy, and the white man comes in and takes credit for her work. Now, we have heard that about 8 billion times. I would say that's hyperbole, but that's probably understating it. Standard operating procedure, and it's important because in medical apartheid, Harriet A. Washington, one of my favorite books all time, also in the book club, she made a point of saying, she made a point of saying how with Nurse Rivers, who was a victim of racism, black female, who was used in the Tuskegee study in Alabama, they would do reports and put her name at the top, as though Nurse Rivers is running the whole syphilis experiment down in Tuskegee, which was not the case at all. That's what I mean about white people are not ignorant about white supremacy racism. Not in 1819, not in 1913, not in 2019. They're not ignorant. They cannot be ignorant. If it's, oh, this nigger is about to get some money or get credit for a discovery. Oh, sit down, Nick. She didn't do anything. This nigger just, you know, swept the floor, cleaned the toilet. That's all she did. I will take credit and get whatever prize recognition. Thank you. And spell out my name letter by letter. If it's something where we know we've done some terrorism. Oh, we poisoned some niggers. Sat around and watched it and had a good time. Made up nicknames about them and everything. That one. Oh, yeah. Put the nigger's name at the top. She was in charge. She ran everything we just did. Did what we told, what she told us to do. Shame how she treated her fellow brothers. The slickness of white supremacy racism. With that, if you could take about 5 minutes to share your comments, questions, suggestions, just to make sure that everybody gets at least one opportunity to speak. If you have additional commentary, if you could wait until everyone has spoken at least once, that would be super appreciated. Also, if you know you are in a noisy environment, if you could use your mute button, that would be splendid. You can just unmute yourself when you're ready to speak. And then once you're done, you can mute your line again. That way, if you are someplace where there's music in the background and you got other people having different conversations, we don't have to compete with all that noise. We can preserve the quality of the broadcast, and then you can unmute if you need to speak again. This is the compensatory call-in, so I do request for this one broadcast, if we could not use metaphors. We heard a number of the Voldemort. Number of metaphors in the broadcast. If we could make an effort to be direct about what we want to say, race soldiers, they regularly employ metaphors, similes, analogies to practice white supremacy racism deception. They will take two separate entities and insist that they are identical, exact same thing, and frequently that is not the case at all. Victims, myself included, we have been exposed to this misconduct for centuries. And many of us, we are still learning, which is fine. But sometimes we don't have logic to articulate our views. And in place of logic, we will use a metaphor or analogy of some sort. And often that just produces more confusion. If we could be direct, specific, exact with what we want to say, that would be grand. If we need more time to think, that is always allowed. I will prompt about the metaphors. Thank you kindly. Also, I want to make sure that I get in the banning of the flavored vaping products. That I think is important. They had a report at the beginning of the week. The Center for Disease Control issued a warning. They said that nationally there had been, I think, 6 fatalities. More people will die from drinking. Probably more people will die from texting and driving this weekend than that. But 6 fatalities and hundreds of respiratory illnesses that seem to be linked to vaping, both nicotine and THC products. And they had a number of different reports talking about this and how this business, vaping products, that it has grown exponentially and in such a short period of time. And they don't have a lot of research on, you know, what are the effects of using these products? What are the effects if you already have a lung ailment or some sort of respiratory condition? What are the effects of long-term use? What are the effects of starting using these products at a young age? Just lots of variables that they said, you know, we're just not sure. They said some people are buying these products on the quote unquote black market, meaning that they're not regulated. So who knows what's in the material? And it reminded me the brilliance, grandsister, Dr. Francis Cress Welsing. One thing that I think may have been minimized in discussing, do we think it's going to be constructive legalizing cannabis, and what does that look like, having, you know, proliferation of all these legal narcotics? Thinking about that in 2013, which is when Dr. Welsing was saying, you know, we don't know what's in it. I've seen black males become psychotic from using these materials. 2013, people saying, yay, we should legalize. I don't think many of them were thinking about these vaping THC devices, because many of them didn't exist in 2013. I don't think that they were thinking about that being the method of consumption. And it has changed drastically just in 5 years, and probably many more changes to come. That's the type of thing that I think Dr. Welsing was saying, that you may be thinking, oh, it's going to be this. This will be what the consumption will look like. This is my schematic for how I view what this will be. And it's something totally different in terms of what racists, they're already thinking 15 years ahead of what this is going to look like, in a totally different way of production, consumption, not to mention, as you stated, what's actually in the product. All of those questions, how does this impact your health in a long term? From a long-term perspective, all of that is super important. And then to see whites intervene at some level to say, man, maybe ban these flavored cigarettes that go into a lot of children, which was another concern that she had originally as well. I also, them banning the flavors, we in our archives, we had that conversation about menthol tobacco cigarettes. Why not ban them? They're super addictive and super deliberately marketed to black people. We talked about that specifically. Why not ban those? Didn't see that happen. The e-vape, the flavored vape products. Oh yeah, let's ban those. Seems like it might be impacting a number of white children. Menthol cigarettes, literally keeping black people from being able to breathe. Yeah. Yeah. With that, I'll save additional comments for later, but thought that was super important. Oh, the last thing, parents cannot be spectators on this one, because we did have a parent dial in yesterday, and she said that her friend, who is a black mom, she had a child, a daughter in school, I believe their daughter's 14, and it was a white child, a race soldier, a classmate, who kept saying nigger deliberately, right next to her. And then he kicked this 14-year-old female. The victim reported this, and apparently the principal and some other white officials said, oh, okay, well, we'll have him apologize. And she didn't want to accept his apology. Bravo. Dr. Welsing talked about that too. She didn't want to accept his apology and said, oh my gosh, what is wrong with you? What more do you want? He said he was sorry, and you're going to reject that? Well, we can't do anything more you. And then they got hostile with her and were discourteous, like she's a bad person or something. And so the mom was thinking, you know, what should be done? The school year just started. It's just September. She's 14. Would it be best to stay in this environment and develop a code on dealing with the racist students, racist staff, to leave? What would be best? We talked about this to some degree yesterday, but I suspect there might be some other parents with us today who might have a thought. It was a non-white child, 14 years old, school year just started. And this is a private Catholic school, for added context. And this young lady is on a scholarship. And at least to me, it seemed like there may have been some element of that racist kind of paternalism. Like, oh my goodness, you know, this nigger is here on a scholarship and you're going to be ungrateful and not accept an apology and cause all this trouble. My gosh, would you want your child to remain at that school and just develop a code? Say, hey, even, you know, if you switch and go to a different school, racism will still be there. Or would you want them to switch and try to find a different alternative for their academic school year? That would be good. Parents, if you have input on that, please share. Do not be a spectator on that subject specifically. Number again is 605-313-3000. 5164, the code 564943, pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. First few folks who dialed in, if you have comments, questions you would like to share, lines should be open. Proceed.
Can I be heard?
Greetings, retired firefighter.
Greetings, Gus. Greetings, everyone. I plan on commenting on Ms. Hill's report, that has gained popularity. I would say that it probably would be a good idea that she have did more extensive research on the subject matter of black males and who are athletes in basketball and football, all of a sudden start attending historical black colleges. Even the term HBCUs is a very confusing term. But I would say that these institutions are not owned and operated and controlled by black people, no more than Harvard or Princeton is. The only difference is that the majority of the population, of the student population at these institutions, are non-white black people. That's the only distinctive, the main distinctive thing about those particular universities. I would suspect that she did not attend a historical black college to have that have some certain cultural knowledge of the institutions themselves. Black males 60, 70 years ago, they went to those schools because the federal state laws demanded that black people could not go to the larger state universities and colleges. And this was your place as a black person. As soon as these institutions started recruiting black males, similar to the idea of the Major League Baseball hiring Jackie Robinson, efficiency athletically of the historical black colleges started going down dramatically. I don't think that's going to reverse itself. And if it does, you would have a situation to whereas, because she mentioned about attracting people at the schools, well, it also would attract white people to go to the schools. There are white people who attend Howard, that attends Florida A&M. And it would perhaps attract more white students and white employees to come to institutions that all of a sudden where a whole lot of money is. And so it's a lot that she needs to do more research on. Anyway, to the question about the 14-year-old, I would say that situations of that nature is probably is not going to diminished by going to another institution. The child may need to get more instructions on a counter-racist code and expect that type of name-calling that would exist with a white person involved. As far as any physical contact, such as hitting or whatever, then that subject matter should be dealt with directly with the parents and the administration directly. And that's all I have to say. Thank you for listening.
much obliged, retired firefighter. We did have people take both sides. We had people who took the perspective that it would be best to be enrolled elsewhere, and people who said it would be best to stay at the school and just develop a code because you'll have racists any school you go to, individuals classified as white. So both perspectives, both logical, just have to figure out what's going to work best for your situation and what your alternatives are. With the piece on the Jemele Hills report, she's a black female victim of racism. I've heard that sentiment before, that view before, in terms of black athletes going to HBCUs. It's, at least in my view, it's similar to the perspective that black NBA athletes or other professional sports should form their own league, as opposed to continuing to have to deal with the Donald Sterlings and racism in professional sports. My view is that both of those perspectives, that is anachronistic thinking. At minimum, it's inaccurate. I think it's anachronistic thinking. Anachronistic thinking is something that is, in relation to time, is out of place. So it's 2019, right. And I'm out here talking, hey, retired firefighter, if I can borrow your horse and buggy, I'm going to gallop down the street to get a loaf of bread. That is anachronistic thinking for 2019, thinking that black people doing this will solve the problem of racism in the NCAA or college sports. That is anachronistic thinking. It is massively inaccurate at minimum if there is a system of white supremacy, which there certainly is. There are many reasons that could point. I mean, we could just start these HBCUs, as they stated in the report, or it wasn't in Jemele Hill's report. It was in the report on Hampton University and them bringing in immigrants from the Bahamas. It was in that report,
right,
that that institution is named after a white man. And I believe they all are. That would be one thing, even just to stop right there, about who's really in charge of these institutions. But just to fast forward,
the first four students.
Oh, hang on one second. The massive amount of terrorism that would come. NCAA, this is a billion-dollar business. Just NCAA football alone. We're not even talking about the basketball component. Just football. Disrupting that money for the University of Alabama, Ohio State, University of Florida. Florida, they just had that big report, Florida State down there, retired firefighter, Tallahassee. Billions of dollars. All of these white boosters and white donors and white college athletic directors. Do you think if it started to be, wait a minute, these little nigger colleges that we set up are scheming to take our nigger athletes? Oh, something must be done. The same thing I said, it could be that, right, you know, Jay-Z is a sellout and he just dissed black, but that could be. But since all of this is about violence at the end of the day, football, it could have been, hey, it would be a shame if something happened to Beyonce. You want to think about that contract now? It could happen that way. It could happen with college athletes. Oh, really? You're going to Morehouse? Oh, my goodness. Be a shame if your mom lost that job, wouldn't it? You think about it. Right. Morehouse, University of Miami. You think about it. I'll stop there. If I'm being illogical in any way, folks can point that out. Let's see. I'm going to get the folks that we've not heard from first. Make sure we nab everybody. Other folks who dialed in with a hand up that we missed totally. If you have commentary, parents can't be spectators here. Proceed. Oh, folks are getting their thoughts together. I guess while we wait for folks either get their thoughts together or get to a place where they can speak, did you want to get your response in now, retired firefighter?
Yes, sir. Thank you. Thank you for allowing me to speak again. I was just going to include, in reference to what you were saying, is that the first four students at Howard University were four white women. Dr. Francis Quest Welsing was fired from an historical, but I mean, we're talking about a person that her method of dealing with non-white people's minds should be the way that psychiatrists should be trained, especially, and she was fired from an institution that's under that label, Historical Black College. I mean, very deceptive title. And they're not controlled by black people at all. I went to two of them, Langston University and Grambling State University, and graduated from two of them. I mean, when it comes to basketball, when it comes to black basketball, black males is one and done. That's a metaphor that states that I'm not even going to this university to learn something and graduate and get a diploma. I'm coming here from the standpoint of the NCAA, which is the main problem, one of the main problems, states that I have to get a certain number of hours before I'm eligible for the NBA. And I believe, I could be wrong, that Mr. LeBron James didn't even go to a college. I could be wrong about that. If he did, he went for 1 year, which is I'm not blaming him for anything, because I think I have a lot of admiration for him and what he's doing. But I'm just saying, I think she needed to do a little bit more research on her studies. Although I do, like Ms. Hill also and what her efforts have been trying to be. I just think that she probably should have done a little bit more research on the interview. Thank you.
Much obliged, sir. Other folks who dialed in that we missed totally, if you have a hand up, *61, line should be open.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir. Greetings, Imhan DC.
Yes, sir. Greetings. I was going to mention this conference. I forgot the name of it, but the last time I said it, the volume was turned down just for the two words of this, the name of this conference. But anyway, it's the one that Bill Gates is involved in. I've done forgot. But that's one of the things I was going to mention. The other thing is just the fact that we need to share the show, we need to end white supremacy as soon as possible. And dealing with the people, like I don't know how to deal with the black people in my city or like anywhere. Like there's been a number of killings I had mentioned before. There was a high number of killings while I was out of the country. Right now, there's fewer, but I'm running into some people who are with guns shooting, just out shooting, and not shooting any person at the moment, but and it's difficult to talk to people. The males, if we are, we're discussing, I'm trying to discuss, there was a shooting over in my neighborhood. Somebody was driving by just shooting, around the house. I don't know if they were shooting at the houses or what, but it was close to my house. They drove by my house. And anyway, and I went and I was asking people, hey, did you see that the vehicle that just went by was shooting? And I was asking people. One of the guys just started cussing me out. It's like, what? Another guy, he was looking around to figure out what was going on because it went past his house too. But then when I was telling him, hey, they had gone past my house and I seen him. He was like, that's his beef talking about. That's my beef now. That's like, yeah, I don't know anybody that's, ain't nobody, coming at me like that. But it's just, I don't know how to talk to people about this problem of black people killing black people. And I think that needs to be addressed, but I don't know how to address it. Thank you.
Much obliged, Imhan DC. I do think Mr. Fuller, him living in Washington, D.C. for the past, he's been there for a long time, decades, more than 25 years, unless I'm in error. And it's a lot of black, even though it's fewer now, but I mean, still, it's a substantial number of black people in the Washington, D.C. area. And I think that has heavily influenced a lot of his dialogue and counter-racist perspective about minimizing conflict, being so critical towards replacing white supremacy with justice, because I think he's seen a lot of the same conflict between black people in D.C. that you are reporting, and black people being violent with other black people, and it even being difficult to raise the conversation with other black people. I've heard him have the same sort of dialogue. He's come on this broadcast and said, just sitting on the bus, and he said it was just hostile. He said it wasn't even that somebody was necessarily attacking him or saying anything, cursing him out or saying anything nasty to him, but it was just, what were they talking about? Hearing how they were talking to other black people, hearing how they were talking on the phone, and he said it just was not constructive for the most part. It was, you know, a lot of conflict in there. And that's what the system of white supremacy produces. I think that's why he says monsters and monstrosities. That's what this system produces. I think in trying to deal with it, I think, one, you just try as best you can to model being someone who is not about conflict, who is about constructive activity. That's why if I live in an area where they don't have a high number of black people, but if I did, that would be full-time occupation, minimizing conflict, minimizing contact would be a big part of that, modeling that behavior so that when people see me, it would be associated with something constructive, trying to offer constructive information or help do something constructive. That would be a big part of it. And just try and talk to the people that you can, realizing that racism, white supremacy, that's why I said I think one of the means of gauging whether or not you're effective, can you produce other non-white people where you can discuss these problems and even help to solve some of these problems? Because this system makes it so difficult. A lot of times it'll be conflict just trying to raise some of these issues, which is what you just said. So I would just try and reach the people that you can. If there are people that you already have a constructive relationship with, if you can start dialogue with them and maybe think of ways to reach out to other folks. I would probably start with that. Folks that you already have constructive contact, try and raise some of these issues and see if you can, what they call brainstorm, think of ideas to try to get more people aware, if it's creating material, if it's writing, but trying to do so in a setting where it can minimize some of that tendency for it to be arguments, and we're just trying to figure out things to, this is a problem. How can we try to minimize some of this conflict, some of this violence between other black people? We'll see if other folks have any suggestions, because it does seem like this is a widespread product of the system of white supremacy. Other folks who dialed in, if you have a hand up and we have missed you totally, line should be open. Proceed.
Hello, may I be heard?
Greetings, Irie.
Hello, how are you? And hello, and I hope everyone else on the line is doing well. I think a couple of weeks ago I called in and reported about how I stepped in with some kids that were out in a popular area that were being harassed by some non-white people who were white identifying and some white people. I ended up speaking with an officer that was made aware of what happened, and he said he had an event number, not a report number, but an event number. So that educated me that, you know, there's at least two phases of reporting, you know, with the police when it comes to things happening. And he let me know that the kids went back in the area to another place, were congregated in a large number, and were participating in very, I don't know what the word would be. I can't remember what he said, but basically the shop they were in front of, the proprietors called the police because they were scaring the customers, so the police officer said, and also doing a lot of horseplay. And I was, I can't say I was surprised, but I was a little bit disappointed because I thought at least the kids would think in the future perhaps about some type of, you know, legal consequences when it came to being in contact with the police, considering that they all knew enough to run off when they saw the police car with sirens coming up with the incident I intervened with. So that was an assumption. I shouldn't have done that. I was projecting. And it just made me really realize how victimized our children are, how confused they are, and how much it's up to us to codify them and help them understand as much as we can as we still learn about the system of racism, white supremacy. It's a, I guess it's a metaphor, but I did feel some physical pain from the footage in the Bahamas. It very much reminded me of New Orleans after the hurricane. It was worse in parts because there's so much water, and you know, like, this is an island, like, it's totally submerged in parts. And I felt a lot of emotional and physical pain for a woman that I can't remember her name, but if you look on Netflix, she was some type of caterer for the fire festival, that festival in which the young white male was able to defraud people of millions of dollars repeatedly for a festival that never happened. And the lady said that she had to borrow from her savings to pay her employees after the man basically stood her up on payments. And I'm just thinking, you know, who knows what's happened to this woman now because of the storm. She had a storm. That's a metaphor, I'm sorry. She had a very, very arduous experience before this hurricane came, and now she's probably out of business, which is what natural disasters do to non-white people, put us out of business, put us out of our homes. And I was mad afterward, after remembering her story prior to the hurricane and now that the hurricane has happened. But I did find out some interesting information from somebody I'm close to that has family in the Bahamas. He said that Nassau, wasn't hit as bad. And that is interesting, as that is, you know, the main, I guess, throughway for tourists. And I'm sure tourists that would classify themselves as white would probably frequent that area more in the Bahamas than other places. So that's interesting that it wasn't as impacted. And the last thing, one of the last things, champagne sharks. I want you to know, Gus, that the way I found out about your show was through a podcast called Champagne Sharks. And they have a Twitter presence, and they're also on Reddit. I don't hear about you mentioning Reddit, but they're on there, and I just wanted to let you know that they're how I found out about your program. And so maybe, I don't know, just maybe listen to their show, check it out. They talk about a variety of things, but they definitely had a part in letting me know. So I'm sure they're letting, you know, from their past episodes, other people are finding out about the context of white supremacy as well. And I'll mute my line for now. Thank you, everybody, for letting me speak. And thank you, Gus. And I hope all is well with everyone. Have a good night.
Much obliged, Irie. Mary Ann Roll, I believe, is the victim's name, the caterer that you are referencing, where the race soldier didn't pay her and she was put into some financial difficulty because of this likely act of racism. Mary Ann Roll, that's her name. Folks want to check out her work. Much obliged for sharing, and I definitely see the similarities. Bahamas, Hurricane Katrina, absolutely. I think they had similar commentary. Some of the main tourist areas in New Orleans were not hit as bad as some of the other areas, Ninth Ward and such. Let's see. Other folks that we have missed entirely, number again, 605-313-5164, the code 564-943-pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. Folks that we missed totally, if you have commentary, question to share, proceed.
Have you heard?
Yes, sir. Greetings.
Greetings, Gus. Greetings to all the callers. Thomas in New York. Gus, I don't know about no little child-sized peaches, man. Are you sure those are really not GMO? That sounds quite large.
I said the size of a one-year-old head, not the size of a child.
Oh, okay, okay. I'm sorry, Gus. I'm sorry. I got you. I was about to say, man, that's an awfully large peach. You know, but I hope your cobbler tastes excellent. You know, I'll send you an address if you want to send me some. I'm just joking with you. The mother of modern science, Henrietta Lacks, at a white yoga studio in Seattle. Thus, I think that when we read the book, we all agreed that Rebecca Skloot was a white supremacist, not a suspect. Especially her actions and taking advantage of that black family, doing very little to get them any compensation other than herself. She made a lot of money and recognition off of it. Probably a fan of Rebecca Skloot, not the book. That's what I'm thinking. Wilmington, man, I've been looking at a lot of stuff on this, doing a lot of reading on Wilmington. For a reason, but white validation and the integration illusion, I think that's really what happened to the black people there. They saw it coming and they did nothing to prepare for it. The newspaper article, the guys, like, they're bringing in a load of guns, like you said. You know, these are our business partners, our neighbors, our constituents, and they turned right on them. Now, I know that white supremacists put lines between North and South Carolina, but when you look at what happened there after slavery, the story in North Carolina mirrors the Ben Tillman story that we did on the book club as well. In North Carolina, these black people had every elected position you could think of. Under the Republican Party, the Democrats were the white supremacists, the more violent ones. It was just very, very much how he took over. You could put Charles Aycock in Ben Tillman's place, and you'll get pretty much the same story, same thing they did in reconstructing white supremacy. The populists with the fusion, they had the same thing where the farmers at first was, after slavery weren't so violent toward the blacks, and then the propaganda, the black rapists, it turned all the poor whites against, it's the same stories. But Manley, who owned the Daily Record, he ran a story saying that white women who were in Area 8 relations with black men did so because they choose to. And that was really the last straw. It was what was needed by the white supremacists to really come to the black people and burn it down and do whatever, because they ran this article for years and rebuttals in all the white newspapers, not only in North Carolina but in Tennessee, all over, and just to stir up white anger behind this black man writing this article like this, and so many people lost their lives because of that. I agree with what you guys said as far as the HBCUs. Black colleges can't compete with white colleges as far as money, facilities. They never will under a system of white supremacy. Don't expect them to under a system of white supremacy. It's just not going to happen. The black players don't need exposure. If they go to a black college, the white supremacists will find them. They look for the best athlete. They don't care what school you go to. So, you know, it's not like if a black player went to a black college, she kind of alluded to that, they'll still get in the NBA, NFL, if they're good enough, without any doubt about it. But a lot of that exposure comes from television. And that's where all that money comes from that supports the colleges. And the NCAA has an exclusive contract with all this television. You're not going to ever be able to compete with that. Too much money. It's an association. So many people are in that association. So many corporations that it's no way. You know, now the flip side would be if the current black athletes would stop donating to the alumni of the white universities they attended that already has a plethora of rich donors, boosters, alumni. They got a huge endowment, not to mention these black athletes probably didn't even graduate from this school, and take that money and donate it toward helping the HBCUs upgrade their academic facilities to be able to compete more with the white schools as far as STEM, you know, science, technology, engineering and mathematics and things like that, where the new economy is going. That, to me, would be more in line with something I would like to see them do, instead of Carmelo giving a $20 million donation to Syracuse for them to build a arena like they really needed his money. And I understand they put his name on it. I don't knock him for doing it. I'm just saying it would have been nice to see that go to, you know, one of the HBCUs who need it. But either way, it's no competition. So it's not even something worth having a conversation over. You know, it's not going to never happen. As far as the HSBUs bringing in the Bahamian students, I think it's way too many black American students who could have used that education right there on where they're at, but it's a noble gesture, I guess, for one semester to bring them here when they probably are needed where they're at so they can rebuild. But yet another storm, sadly, that I would deem as a fake storm, a weather anomaly that shouldn't happen. And even the president came out and he put out a map, and I was looking at the same map. It's called Ventusky, Ventusky. That's the website, and you can see the storms forming, days of advance, and how they travel. And this storm was going to hit Florida, go across, and go into Alabama. I was looking at it today, calling my mother down in Florida. Mom, you know, at this storm. And the second the president went on the news with that, this thing stopped. And boy, it was going like about 175 miles an hour and stopped. And then started traveling 1 mile an hour over the Bahamas and just destroyed it. And they turned it. Then it just went up the coast. And they said, oh, he's an idiot. I'm not no fool. I know a hurricane is supposed to do that. You can't stop something going that fast. You can't stop a car going that fast and just reroute it just like that. It's just a weather anomaly, like a hurricane being over Texas for 5 days, or one that zigzags through Florida, Georgia, North Carolina, just stuff that shouldn't happen. You know, a hurricane hit in London a few years ago just shouldn't happen. I mute my line. Thank you.
Much obliged, Thomas, in New York. I will let you all know once I get information on why the Henrietta Lacks book is at the yoga studio. More details to come. I engaged in a bit of horseplay myself. I made a note to say that when Irie was sharing about the young children that she intervened on behalf of previously. And then apparently she was told that they engaged in what they call horseplay later on and made the patrons, probably whites, feel unsafe. I engaged in horseplay as a child. I think it's pretty common. In fact, it seems a lot of adults engage in horseplay. They have no horseplay rules on a number of work sites, apparently. But I engaged in horseplay as a child. Normally, that's not considered criminally threatening, just, you know, being a child and engaging in a little tomfoolery. But I totally understand your concern and hoping that they would kind of heed your warnings and adjust their conduct. Sometimes children, the metaphor, I think, have to learn the hard way. System of racism, white supremacy. Folks, we missed totally. If you have a hand up, proceed. Let's see, while folks are waiting to get their hands up, 605-313-5164, the code 564-943-pound. Press star 61 if you would like to participate. With the HBCUs, I had even seen reports where they were saying there had been an increasing number of non-black students who were attending HBCUs, and they were listing a variety of reasons. It was, you know, cost effective or, you know, whatever the case is. But they had just said that in the last few years, in addition to the HBCU struggling and, you know, not having adequate resources. I think they could wait and pull out that report. I think it was Grambling where they said the athletic facilities were really bad and they protested. I think they said they had mold in the athletic facilities. They could pull that out. Like, oh my gosh, you're going to go to one of these, you know, no count schools. My goodness. Like, look at the facilities that we have. Lots of different ways that in a system of racism, white supremacy, it's just not proud. That's why I said this program is titled The Cows. I feel like many conversations, they don't make sense once we acknowledge, oh, we're in a system of racism, white supremacy. Things would have to be discussed in proper context. Dr. Welsing said that the word context was said a number of times in the audio segments today. Context. Sometimes it can be fun to think about things hypothetically as though we were not confined by the logic, the constraints of white supremacy. Unfortunately, we are. That whole conversation, in my view, it ends abruptly. System of white supremacy. Let's just go about solving the problem. Maybe not even playing football at all. Maybe that would be best under this system. A little less brain damage for the victims. Let's see.
Can I say one thing about that, please?
Yes, sir. Thomas.
I had it written down. I got it. With the number one group, besides the television affiliated with the NCAA, is the major professional sport leagues. So the day that the HSBCUs, all of this stuff did happen, and they got all the black players to go there, the professional leagues would just take away the need for going to college. So no longer do you need a college education to play professional sports out in all of that.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Did you see Wilmington on fire? Just asking, she said you were researching the 1898 terrorism.
Oh, yeah, I saw that.
Excellent film. Christopher Everett. Outstanding work. Outstanding work. Try to promote him when I can. Other folks have questions, comments that they wanted to share. Certainly, if we have any parents, if you have thoughts on the situation with the 14-year-old, stay at the same school, relocate, definitely would appreciate a thought there. Folks that we missed totally, if you have thoughts, or other folks if you have suggestions, comments, proceed. Seems like we have other folks with hands up. Maybe they're in a noisy environment. We'll check back once they get to a space maybe where they can.
Can I be heard in the meantime?
Retired firefighter. Yes, sir.
Yes, I think I need to also include a remedy for the problem with the 14-year-old, if it's feasible and possible, that the child will be homeschooled for the rest of their grade school career. Also, with the situation with Grambling, what you were referring to, Douglas Williams, former MVP of a Super Bowl, who became head football coach at Grambling, which was his alma mater. I played against him in college. He was fired from the head coaching position because he was attempting to remedy that problem that you were talking about that was at that legendary historical black college, Grambling State University. He had his own contacts that were attempting to improve the facilities. That's the normal shape of the historical, quote-unquote, black colleges, which I say the title itself is very deceptive. These places are not controlled by black people at all. So I don't even know why she even brought that particular. We need 6'8" doctors. We need 6'8" doctors. We need quote unquote black lawyers who can run the 40 and 4 flat to get from you to some sort of means of legal assistance. That's what we need more so than anything. I wouldn't have been able to finance to go to college if I hadn't had a quote unquote athletic scholarship. But outside of that, to talk about some professional sports, I can care less about it at all. And most of these guys, and I've coached a lot of them, a lot of them are not even interested in going to college to learn something and get a diploma. A lot of them aren't.
Absolutely. Absolutely. We need more. It is a metaphor, but I'm doing it deliberately just because we did play the clip today. More Alice Balls, black scientists who will help us solve this problem, thinking in a logical, scientific manner that will, I think,
yes, sir,
help us get this here problem solved immediately, not just having, you know, more black athletes out on the gridiron getting brain damage. Save that brain,
yes,
computer.
Sir.
Man, we have got problems to solve much greater than getting a touchdown or scoring 2 points. Let's see. And with the homeschool situation, that great suggestion. I know for some folks that can be, you know, a challenge. That's another one that I know, just being here in Washington State, where they have a comparatively lower number of individuals classified as black, the homeschool options are extraordinary. Like, you can tailor the program to make it really specific to meet the needs of your child. If that includes going to school for maybe one class and then everything else is at home, you can do that. They have all kinds of resources so that they still get the social interaction. It is amazing how just the experience that you can have for your child in the state of Washington if you want to do homeschooling that would not be available to you if you lived in a state that has a higher population of black people. Anywho, other folks who dialed in, if you have a hand up, if you have comments, questions to share, proceed.
Hi, everyone. This is Misty. And non-Clemson grad is here as well. I wanted to call this in really quick. I wrote an email to Gus, but I was like, oh, yeah, I can call my cell phone. but I wanted to make a comment on the vaping report. I remember being in Washington, D.C. back in 2014. I was there for like a summer program, and there were a lot of like young white people who were vaping. They had just started vaping and they were trying to like spread the word and be like, oh yeah, you want to try it, you want to puff, all this kind of stuff. And they were very proud about vaping inside of the subways. They would while we were waiting for the trains to arrive, they would blow smoke into each other's faces or make the little smoke circles in the air. And then on the non-peak hours in the evening, when there were fewer riders coming from certain parts of the city, they would file into the train cabins and then, you know, puff, 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 and fill up the entire train cabin full of the smoke. And the way that the vaping was marketed to young people and to people who may have been smoking tobacco, like cigarettes or cigars, they would market vaping as a safe alternative to tobacco. And then another angle that they would position or encourage people to switch to vaping or to at least try it was to bypass some of the legislation that businesses or different public places adopted to have some of these places be completely tobacco-free. So it was a good way to say, hey, I'm not smoking something tobacco, full of tobacco. I can still get my nicotine, and I can smoke indoors without harming anybody else around me with the second or third hand smoke. But I also recall back in 2014, 2015, when vaping became the rage, there were plenty of reports that came out warning users of the potentially long-term health impact of vaping. And a lot of people said it was unfounded, as mentioned in the report in some of the comments, that because they haven't researched or done a lot of analysis or studies on the effects of vaping, a lot of people were saying that the reports were unfounded. But just to keep this in perspective, like when you're vaping, in order to use the device and inhale the nicotine and the flavor of the nicotine, the device itself, it has to heat up, and there's metal coils inside that have to heat up to heat the liquid nitrogen. And then when you inhale and exhale, it turns it into the liquid nitrogen into the smoke. In the smoke, you'll see at different parties and stuff, it's like that liquid ice that you'll see maybe at Halloween, that creates these cool effects at concerts and stuff. It's very, very similar to that. It's liquid nitrogen. But as the user inhales the flavor, the nicotine, the liquid compound, they're also inhaling toxic heavy metals. And some of the heavy metals that are very toxic to you, that we know in large concentrations are negatively impact our bodies as humans. You have like aluminum, nickel, arsenic, lead, manganese, chromium, and other metals that you can look up. So what I like to remind everybody is sobriety is best. And when these businesses, they try to market to us either through billboards or magazine spreads or television or even using young, attractive, healthy-looking white people. They're trying to make money. The dominant society is trying to make money, and they'll heavily target non-white people because there's so much money to extract from non-white people. So the dominant society, it's a great money-making cycle. They will create a problem, in this case, a health crisis. So they'll make money through creating the problem and selling us, in this case, the vaping alternative to tobacco. They'll make money by researching, analyzing the problem, or holding conferences and publishing reports and papers. And they also make money selling the solution back to us. And with that, I will conclude.
Much obliged, Miss C. Hope everyone is doing well in South Carolina, non-Clemson grad as well. The vaping, they are so slick. I remember all the promotion. I remember that exactly here in Washington State, even before they legalized cannabis. I remember the vaping, the e-cigarettes and all the nicotine vaporizers that they had. And it was amazing. It just seemed in a matter of days, it seemed all of the young whites had them. When I say young whites, like high school students had them. You would just see them out all the time in restaurants. In restaurants, I can't emphasize that enough because you can't even smoke like a cigarette in a restaurant, but they had their vape devices in restaurants using them. And, you know, I think she said on the train and, you know, public transportation and just out in public and all over the place. It's been extraordinary. And then you add in that, because they were talking about both the e-cigarette and THC vaporizers, both, and saying that they don't know and it hasn't been studied and, you know, this is a concern and maybe people shouldn't be doing this at all. Maybe this is not a healthier alternative. All of that. That moron says, I think it was just repeated, sobriety would be best under conditions of white supremacy. Absolutely. Other folks that we missed totally. If you have a hand up, comment, question, you want to make sure you share. Proceed.
May I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Yes. Good evening, Gus. Good evening, listeners and callers. I wanted to share part of my part of my viewpoint on the 14-year-old who's being subjected to terrorism. I agree, like I said, the homeschooling is a great alternative. I like that idea. But notwithstanding that, because I believe you said that she already committed to a scholarship. So it would take a parent, like I said, as a parent, I think I would, as an attempted parent, I think I would sit down and try to best prepare my child to be subjected to terrorism and try to get them codified and sit with them and read some of the suggestions by Mr. Fuller and actually have them listen to some of the programs. And that could be a definitely a learning experience. I intend to do that because I'm going to visit my children, my grandchildren shortly. So it's part of my continued codification to have them being prepared. So I think short of removing him from that environment would be to best prepare him to be able to respond logically and unemotionally so he doesn't put himself in further jeopardy. And I'll meet my line with that. Thank you.
This is a 14-year-old young lady that we were discussing, but the logic would be the same. Much obliged for the suggestion, sir. If we have any other parents, try not to be a spectator if you have thoughts on how you would handle that situation. Got another vote for homeschooling as well. Other folks who dialed in with a hand up, if we have missed you totally and you have commentary to share, lines should be open. Proceed. Check in, see if some of the other folks who still have a hand up that we missed will check in again, see if we missed them. Other folks, if you all have any other comments, questions, remarks you want to make sure you get in. I did neglect to include a report. It was a black male. He was attacked by three white men. And this is a younger black male. I think he was, you know, a teen. And they called him a nigger and all the rest of it. Just again, to emphasize the importance, being alert, that is kind of connected or not kind of directly connected to sobriety would be best, because we are under conditions of terrorism. And there have been so many incidents of just random violence, just to be alert, to be aware of things that are happening, so that we can kind of recognize when danger might be increased. We might need to take evasive action. It is super important to just be aware of your environment. Have these conversations with your children. As I said, this was a younger black male. Have these conversations so that they can be aware. I know I've seen a number of reports of black children, males and females, boys and girls, being attacked, sometimes even shot at on the way to school or home from school. So as the previous caller just stated, be having these conversations with your offspring if they are going to public school or whatever it is. Be having these conversations and make sure they have a code in terms of what to do if something should happen, if they're in transit, what to do if something should happen in the classroom, student, whatever it is, and repeat these conversations. This is not a one-time thing. This is regular dialogue, checking in with them. A lot of work being an attempted parent. School year just started. Use all of this as motivation to make sure you are talking to your child. What's the code? Someone calls you a nigger. This is the code, and we can practice that so it'll be really natural. They've already rehearsed this. They know what to do. They know how you have instructed them to behave. Let's see. Other folks have comments, thoughts, questions they want to share.
Can I be heard?
Mr. M. Hondisi.
Yes, sir. I had to hang up because I was trying to record the airplanes that drew an X over the moon. Apparently, the moon is reflecting too much heat tonight. Chemtrails. White people are going to continue to spray chemtrails until white supremacy ends, I think. But we should do our best to make sure white people have a hard time spraying these chemtrails by whatever the process is, speaking to politicians or whoever makes the rules, white people. But I remembered Bilderberg Conference. And I don't even know what that even is, really. But that's the word I had said, the two words I had said maybe a few weeks ago that was omitted from the live broadcast. I don't even know. But I read that Bill Gates is involved in that conference, and it has to do with depopulation. However, whenever I was mentioning that particular Bilderberg conference, that's not even what I was meaning to say. I meant to say it was another speech that Bill Gates had given, a public speech that Bill Gates had given, where if you just listen to what he said, he was basically saying that in order to lower the temperature of the planet, white people have to kill a certain number of black people to accomplish lowering the temperature. And so the other thing I wanted to mention was with the shootings that I had mentioned before. They've decreased, and they decrease especially, you know, when people are looking around. But like, I don't know, it's just, there's a group of people going around terrorizing this neighborhood. And it's like, I'm starting to understand the dynamic more, but I've thought this, there's a group of black people even that is going around and doing killings and getting away with it. But the reason they even get away with it is because the police won't stop them. Even when the shooting happened around my house, this guy was shooting down two blocks early in the morning, past houses. The time that children go to the bus stop, and nobody stepped out of the house to see, you know, the car, but I went and tried to figure out what it was. But the police, they got called and they didn't respond immediately. I mean, they answered the phone and whatever, but they didn't come to the scene. If they had come soon, they could have even found the car, you know? If they had sent maybe three cars, like whenever when I see them stop somebody on the side of the road, they'll have 10 cars for some black person who you can't even figure out what the violation was. But they couldn't send anybody out to this shooting that happened beside my house. And I can walk faster. I can walk to where they are because they're stationed close to me. I can walk to the police station and back before the time they even got to the to the scene. And it was even longer than that. It was like a ridiculous amount of time. It had to have been like 15 minutes or something, you know, or longer. It was a ridiculous amount of time. And so, excuse me for yelling, but yeah, it's something that needs to be dealt with. Thank you.
Imhan DC, that is consistent with regards to, at times, when it benefits the system of racism, racists will not intervene. They will, monsters and monstrosities, said that before, they will produce non-white people that they control, terrorize, and dominate. They will produce individuals who behave in this manner. And then sometimes they'll just stand back and do nothing about it. You can see that on a global scale. They brag about Rwanda almost on a regular basis. The same thing happening there. And yep, Bill Clinton, president at the time, we sat and watched and let them slaughter each other by the hundreds of thousands. And they do this on a small scale sometimes. We'll just sit back, let the black people kill each other. Maybe we intervene. Maybe we don't. You drive down the street and forget your license, we'll call 20 enforcement officials to come out for that infraction. System of racism, white supremacy, local, national, global. Other folks, and it is straight, it's designed. The amount, the stress that we heard from Imhan DC, that is a part of the design, to have black people stressed, to impact your health, and being on edge. I think that even explains to some degree some of the responses where the people were on edge and angry. When you're stressed and you have violence happening on a mass scale to black people all around you and nothing is done about it, that creates people who are functioning with post-traumatic stress syndrome. You can't even call it post because it's current. Just white supremacy stress reactions to the things that are happening in their environment. Other folks dialed in, suggestions, questions that they wanted to share.
Can I be heard again?
Retired firefighter? Yes, sir.
Yes, I need to include that DCS mentoring program has had their annual parent meeting, which precedes the another session, which would take place in the latter part of this month. These are the type of programs that could assist attempted non-white black parents with their black male children, to assist them in what way? To assist them in the way of building, so that individual can build a format of what am I, what's the purpose of a high school diploma, what do I need, what do I go to college for, or some other sort of training, that sort of thing. Something that would accentuate more than just playing a sport. It can assist a parent in so. Also, what I have always done through coaching is to follow through
with the young people that I have been in their company with a whistle. It's more than that. I stay with them and contact them, the ones who have went to college, as far as to keep reinforcing the idea of having a plan, and also to have a counter racist plan also, which I am unfortunately unique at as far as coaching is concerned down here in South Florida. A matter of fact, one of the they call me all the time, but I was called last night. A young fellow who I coached he went to University of Louisville and finished with a degree, but he also at the same time he's a realtor and he has the interest of becoming a firefighter. And he was calling me on that because he already has been taking himself through the training, that sort of thing. These are some of the things as far as what young people need. And I would say sports can be a facilitator, an assistance to that, if that the persons who are involved with it have that know-how and interest to want to be able to use that platform for that purpose, which I do think is paramount. And I try to do that. And that's all I have to say. Thank you.
Much obliged, retired firefighter. Things greater than scoring a touchdown. Absolutely. Let's see. Other folks with questions, suggestions, comments they wanted to make sure they share before we wrap things up.
Can I be heard?
Thomas in New York? Yes, sir.
Yes. The Bilderberg Group set up by very powerful German Nazis who evaded the investors for war crime by being allowed to move to the Netherlands and change their name. But they set up the Bilderberg Group in 1956, and several U.S. People go there every year, set certain agendas corporately and all around world government. They have a very exclusive group of people that fit governmental positions. Even black people have gone and been part of this group. But very powerful secret society type group. All the white universities on major television playing college sports have, first and foremost, world-class academic facilities, classrooms, and labs. Sports come second. In fact, the colleges that the white supremacists, they are their elite schools, you almost never see them glamorized in modern times as great athletic schools, like Harvard and Princeton and Yale and those schools. You won't see them on playing on Saturday football, in the Sweet 16, because their white people are more, first and foremost, concerned with being academically superior, knowing more than everyone else. That's how they stay in power. And HBCUs, instead of worrying about sports, they need to worry about getting equal academically to those schools. I think that would be the number one focus they should be worried about. The NBA players, I hate to keep it on sports, Gus, but I get very disappointed when I see one thing that black people are allowed to do in the system of white supremacy, and do it well, better than white people, is play sports. And we turn around and lose to another country. This is something I saw coming. I think I mentioned on the show before, they were changing basketball to allow these white supremacists to be able to be a part of the NBA league. So now all the jump shooting, three-point shot, changing the way it's played, no inside, no athleticism, that in the places where we used to dominate, if you play that way, you don't even get a chance. You know, you have to be able to shoot a jump shot and get back and play defense, and that's about it. So I think that you're seeing that the result of that, finally, after about 20 years, they can't even win in the Olympics. Or in the world setting against players who are playing that style of ball. You just got to catch, shoot, and get back and play defense. And that's never been our strong point, what made the NBA what it is. So I think that in the next 5 to 10 years, you're going to see about 50% of the league going to be non-American whites, or just non-American, non-black people, I should say. Can I mute my line, Gus?
We shall see. We shall see. Last few minutes in the broadcast, folks have any other remaining comments they want to make sure that they share. I think, not that I'm encouraging film watching, but I think the film on Harriet Tubman is about to come out sometime soon. The Toronto International Film Festival was this week, and I think it screened there. And I am told it got good reviews. Obviously, I wasn't there. But I think that should be coming out. I've said for a long time I don't do slave pictures, and this would be another one. So I'm not going to watch this. But that might be something to be just mindful if people are talking about it or asking you, have you seen it? If you start seeing the previews and such for it, it might be constructive. It might be great. I'm sure there are a lot of non-white, especially younger people. We've been talking about that. I am sure there are a lot of 14-year-old black boys and girls who do not know who Harriet Tubman is, or who have a very limited understanding of her. Probably even a lot of older black boys and girls who that would also apply. So I'm sure it would be helpful in some respect, but I'm very accustomed to the system of white supremacy and producing what I would term just racial pornography and producing these sort of films, Roots. It's a lot of them. I could go through the list. Even I would put The Help. There are a lot of books and films of this nature. They enjoy reminiscing about the good old days on the plantation. Make America great again. Ah, yes, we had impunity to lash a nigger from sun up to sundown. Oh, well, at least we can watch a film and see it. We can rewind it, watch it in slow-mo. I think I've written about that. We've talked about that, making a spectacle of terrorizing black people. That I've just concluded that that's all of these type of efforts, film efforts. But Harriet is supposed to be out. I guess if you hear or see about it, you can let us know if you think it's constructive. Any other comments, questions, suggestions?
I see this Harriet Tubman movie as trying not to use a metaphor, a trap. Well, it's setting us up. I hope that's not a metaphor. But they already told us, like, last year, 2 years ago, that they was coming out with Harriet Tubman $10 or $20 bills. So they're going to build her up in this movie. And, of course, if the white supremacists like it, I wouldn't think it's going to be that constructive. If this was constructive, they would say this was the worst movie ever. This would not be going to movie theaters. But they're going to build her up just in one day to have a rapper throwing some Harriet Tubman bills at a stripper. I could see it happening. And I just the master plan of white people, it just the visual of that, I could just see that being what they're doing.
Always suspicious. I first heard about the project some years back, and I'm not sure if I had my code about, you know, I do not view these type of films, but it is staunchly in place now. And yeah, I would just expect that this will be used in some sort of way. Even when Nate Parker's project comes out, he's going to show Nat Turner, and then that just turns into a whole cowbell. He's a rapist. And they got lots of schemes. Any other comments, questions, suggestions?
May I be heard?
Greetings, caller in Florida.
Yes, sir. Thank you very much, sir. Greetings to Gus, the host, the listeners and callers. I was tending to some things I was trying to get done. I was going to speak earlier, but Gus, it was a story that was on the news earlier this week. It looks like it was a black male up in Tallahassee, I guess, who stabbed five people in the workplace. I was trying to look into the story to see if it was in response to workplace racism. But the article that I found says that the person that he wigged out, and they got it in quotes, and it was saying that he was in good spirits before he got to work. And he clocked in, and it said that on the article that he overheard some supervisors speaking in code. And I said, really, they have speaking in code in the article. So they, I guess, got into some altercation, the supervisors, and his name is Antoine Brown. He's 41. And he was asked to clock out at like 8:20 or something like that. And I guess they saw him going for his pocket or something, and they asked him to leave. And I guess in the aftermath or after the incident, he said that he saw demons and certain people that he stabbed, because it said that he said the persons he stabbed had wronged either him or a previous employee. So in my opinion, I'm wondering if that has something to do with racism, when especially when you have victims that are confused, and I guess he used the term they had wronged him and previous employees. So I wonder if that was about racism. Had anybody heard about that story?
I had not. I am reading it now, the details from CNN about the stabbing that took place. But this report doesn't say anything either about if racism was an issue and that sort of thing. Yeah, it doesn't. I would be suspicious anytime a black person in a workplace setting and they're saying that they had grievances and what have you, because it just seems like so frequently racism is a part of, you know, what has taken place. But yeah, I did not know about this incident.
Yes, sir. That was an interesting one that really got my attention and focused on it. And one last thing, I just wanted to really compliment the style of this broadcast, like the way that people are allowed to speak and give their viewpoints. It really teaches me just to speak on my own individualist experience. It's thought-provoking, and I get to learn more, and I get to hear different viewpoints and opinions. And usually, like on a lot of not just television broadcasts, like radio broadcasts, you hear a lot of people speaking, and then you hear background music. But with this, it's definitely it stands out in my opinion. And you know, I just wanted to compliment you and the other callers on that. And that's all I have for now. Thanks for allowing me to share.
Much obliged. Hope it is worthy of folks' time and energy. And even more importantly, hope it is contributing to us being able to solve the problem immediately. I'm looking at one other report. This is the Tallahassee Democrat about this incident with Antoine D. Brown, the alleged perpetrator in this stabbing down in Florida. And they said that, let's see, oh, potential termination. Let's see. I think they're saying that he had a history of run-ins with enforcement officials, but this is just kind of going over details of the attack and all of that. The only reason I clicked on it was to see if they were going to give more details and say that, let's see. Yeah, it doesn't give out the details. The title was misleading. Yeah, see, the title says suspect in spontaneous Tallahassee workplace attack had string of run-ins with the law, but then it doesn't give any details about these run-ins with the law unless I missed them. But, yeah, I don't see them. Anyway, I don't see any of the details about these run-ins with the law. With that, did we miss anybody? Anything you can get in 30 seconds or less before we wrap things up? Right on. I assume folks are satisfied. I'm still kind of stuck in my craw. Our listener who dialed in and was trying to get information to deal with the problem being banned from the lactation room on her job still kind of messed with me and trying to get out some more helpful solutions, even though she did write back and say that what she heard was helpful. So I am trying to see if we can get Black guests specifically who deal with that in trying to get assistance with breastfeeding while you're working and some of the common problems, because that's something I just, as a non-parent, not a mom either, something I just hadn't thought about. But we're going to try and see if we can get that set up as well. You can drop an email if you have questions, need information about the Cows Yoga Retreat for Florida, December 28 to January 1. Hopefully there will be no hurricanes by the end of December, so we can be there safely, enjoy some sunshine, some excellent veggie food, maybe not vegan peach cobbler, but something tasty. Many things tasty, hopefully. Do some yoga and discuss counter-racism, how we can go about solving the problem. UntilJustice@gmail.com. If you have questions, need more information, much obliged to all the folks who participated. Hope it was worthy of your Saturday evening. Check Black Talk Radio Network and our Facebook group for details on our next broadcast when we'll be back on this week. The iTunes is still allowing me to upload. I think I have all of the broadcasts from the 2019 calendar year have been uploaded to iTunes. Now I'm just working on making sure that everything is uploaded from where the problem began in the summer of 2018. So hopefully we'll be able to go back and get iTunes totally updated. I know that makes it easier for some listeners to access the content. So if you're looking for any of the most recent content, 2019 should be available via iTunes. With that, I get to say it again. Sobriety would be best under conditions of white supremacy. For a myriad of reasons. I don't think vaping, coconut flavor, apple flavor, sour apple, menthol, anything. I don't think that alcoholic beverages, cigarettes, even the tobacco. I don't think any of that has helped us end this problem. I don't think any of that is going to help us end this problem. Let's keep our brain computers working at maximum efficiency to crank out new concepts, permanent solutions to the problem, the system of white supremacy. In addition to being sober, let's be buckled up every time we are in a vehicle, driver or passenger, and let's make sure we are not on the cell phone when we are driving. Let's do even the little things that can help keep us a little bit safer. And out of the clutches of Daniel Pantaleo, Daniel Holtzclaw, and all of the rest under this system. That said, Creator, we ask that you help us remain patient with other Black people, victims of white supremacy. We ask that you help us remain patient with ourselves. Help us demonstrate the highest levels of Black self-respect at all times, in all places, each and every time we are in contact with another Black person. It has been time. Replace white supremacy with justice immediately. Cow signing out. Thanks all for tuning in.
Nigga, you're so brainwashed.
I'm a victim, brother.
No problem. You're a victim. I'm a victim of 400 years of conditioning.
Shut up.
The man has programmed my conditioning. Mm-hmm. Even my conditioning has been conditioned.